Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
You know, the black president today went on television and literally cried. You know, a sad day, in my opinion, in black history, to see the first and hopefully last black man to ever have the dishonor to serve as the highest administrator of white supremacy in the United States. She's been consistently criticized for 8 years for being weak, and the only thing he's probably been criticized more than that is being over his head. But see him crying on TV was sad. And crying over more laws, rules, codes, regulations added to the existing gun laws that are already exclude a huge percentage of black people to own weapons. He wants to change those. He even referenced the kids in Chicago. Like the people shooting in the ghettos are getting them from gun shows and legally from stores. The welding moment in that was, you know, and what I would love to have asked her is to see him sitting there trying to essentially castrate white people by taking their guns away. I expect a lot of retaliation against black people for what he's doing. White men are not going to let themselves be castrated, especially for someone who can genetically annihilate them.
Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, who was also a New York City cop previously, was among those at President Obama's CNN town hall meeting on guns in Virginia last night. Did you happen to watch? We'll talk to the Borough President in a minute. Let me first play one of the exchanges from the event. The President did take questions from critics as well as supporters of his executive action this week, expanding background checks to people who buy from smaller gun dealers in person and online. One of those critics was a woman named Kimberly Corbin, who, as you'll hear, explains why she owns a gun for protection.
As a survivor of rape and now a mother to two small children, you know, it seems like being able to purchase a firearm of my choosing and being able to carry that wherever me and my family are, it seems like my basic responsibility as a parent at this point. I have been unspeakably victimized once already, and I refuse to let that happen again to myself or my kids. So why can't your administration see that these restrictions that you're putting to make it harder for me to own a gun or harder for me to take that where I need to be is actually just making my kids and I less safe?
Now, the president gave a long answer to Ms. Corbin that involved various issues, but the heart of it was this.
So there really is nothing that we're proposing that prevents you or makes it harder for you to purchase a firearm if you need one.
And by contrast, the president said this.
What I just want to focus on is that you certainly would like to make it a little harder for that assailant to have also had a gun. You certainly would want to make sure that if he gets released, that he now can't do what he did to you to somebody else. And it's going to be easier for us to prevent him from getting a gun if there's a strong background system in place, background check system in place.
President Obama and one of the participants at the town hall on guns in Virginia, live on CNN last night. We'll play another excerpt coming up. But also in attendance was Brooklyn Borough President and former New York City police officer Eric Adams, who joins me now. Hi, Borough President. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, how are you? It's always good being on with you.
And always good having you. And if I could start here, what did you think of that specific interaction in particular?
I didn't hear it, but I believe that was an interaction with the law enforcement person.
Sorry, I gather you couldn't hear that clip we were playing. It was the woman who had been a rape victim who was asking the president why, since I want to own a gun now to protect myself in the future and my children, are you making it harder for me with these proposals? And the president said it wouldn't really make it harder for you because you wouldn't fail a background check. It would make it harder for your assailant when he gets out of prison. Did you notice that interaction when it went by last night?
Yes, and I thought the same thing when I heard her. And that is what is so important here. When you dig in so deep on your fears and belief, you don't allow yourself the opportunity to be a deep listener and hear exactly what is being said to you. And we should always seek first to understand and then be understood. And across the country, we're not seeking to understand. What the president is simply saying, something that I embrace, because I am a gun owner. I own three guns, and I believe that Americans should have the right to own guns. But hey, before you get the gun, do a background check. And that's what the president is saying. He's not saying that rape victims or victims of crimes or people who live in isolated and desolate areas should not have the right to have their constitutional right to buy guns. He's saying before you do so, you should have a background check that, one, that you're not a criminal, two, you're not dealing with some mental disability that prevents you from handling this very serious tool that we have in America.
Why do you own three guns?
As a former police officer, I had guns. My parents and my families and grandparents come from a long traditions of hunters, and as well as I do target practice. And so I have it for recreation and also have it as a form of protection inside my household. I believe that Americans that feel they should have a gun in their home, they have a right to do so as long as they're trained to have it and as long as they hold it in a manner that is not going to endanger their family members. And that's why I'm a strong believer in the right of Americans being able to carry and have guns.
The other part of the president's response to Ms. Corbin that we didn't just replay was a kind of questioning of whether it puts her children more at risk or, you know, adds additional safety to even have a gun in the house. Did you think he was right to raise that as a question? And do you have an answer to that for yourself?
Yes, and we should raise it as a question, because oftentimes we talk about those who are the victim of crimes from handguns. But the real problem, which is almost two-thirds of the people, are the victims of suicide and accidental shootings. We had a case in a store, I believe it was last year, a year and a half, where a baby picked up his mother's gun. And when children take a gun, they normally have it pointed towards them because they look at the barrel of it, and he shot himself. And so you have a lot of cases where you have accidental discharges and people use guns in suicides when they go through a very difficult period. And you need to, one needs to think about that when you have a gun at home. That's why I'm strong on smart technology, and we're going to announce an initiative here in the city where we want to team up with our institutions of higher learning and the police department to bypass gun manufacturers who are intimidated by the NRA and come up with ways of moving this technology forward. It is remarkable that the only place where we are inhibiting and looking at technology improving a product is in firearms. That should no longer take place, and we should bypass those who are preventing that from happening. Smart technology is the way to go, not only to find guns that are lost, but also to prevent them from being used by individuals who you were not intending to use that gun.
So here's another exchange from last night. This speaker, very supportive of the president this time, is astronaut Mark Kelly, husband of former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who, of course, was injured in one of the mass shootings. And Kelly asked kind of a sarcastic question in support of the president.
But when we testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, we heard not only from the gun lobby, but from United States senators that expanding background checks will, not may, will lead to a registry, which will lead to confiscation, which will lead to a tyrannical government. So I would like you to explain, with 350 million guns in 65 million places, households, from Key West to Alaska, 350 million objects in 65 million places, if the federal government wanted to confiscate those objects, how would they do that?
So the president, as we'll hear, begins to respond to Kelly, and then you'll hear the moderator, Anderson Cooper, follow up.
What I think Mark is alluding to is what I said earlier, this notion of a conspiracy out there, and it gets wrapped up in concerns about the federal government. Now, there's a long history of that. That's in our DNA. You know, the United States was born suspicious of some distant authority.
But let me just jump in. Is it fair to call it a conspiracy? I mean, there's a lot of people really believe this deeply, that they just don't.
No, they just don't
trust you.
I'm sorry, Cooper. Yes, it is fair to call it a conspiracy. What are you saying? Are you suggesting that the notion that we are creating a plot to take everybody's guns away so that we can impose martial law
is
a conspiracy? Yes, that is a conspiracy. I would hope that you would agree with that.
Borough President, what did you think of that exchange?
I thought it was a very colorful exchange, and I thought that Anderson Cooper was right to raise the question, because in the audience was not merely those who are supportive of sensible gun laws, but it was those who support the belief that it is a conspiracy. And so for him not to raise it would have given the impression that there was a one-sided town hall, which it was not. There were those on both ends of the spectrum. But I share the president's belief there is no conspiracy of removing 65 million handguns and taking away the right to bear arms. There is a desire, as we have always done in this country, to improve the safety of any product, and a gun is a product, no different than the other products that we have improved the safety. We have not allowed the evolution of handguns to be a safer tool that is used in a recreational fashion or in a public protection fashion, and that cannot continue to happen.
There is about to be another political battle over gun control. President Obama is spelling out the steps he's taking to sidestep Congress and address gun violence.
It will potentially save lives in this country and spare families the pain and the extraordinary loss that they've suffered as a consequence of a firearm being in the hands of the wrong people.
He had that to say at a meeting today with the Attorney General, the Director of the FBI, and the head of the ATF. When he has tried to pass gun control legislation in the past, he has been blocked by Congress, so he's turning to regulatory action instead. One proposal is designed to make it harder for gun buyers to avoid background checks. NPR's Scott Horsley reports that if history is any guide, the president's effort could have the unintended effect of increasing gun sales.
2015 was a banner year for gun sales, and already 2016 looks to be off to a good start. John Lamplew has been running gun shows for more than three decades in Maryland and Pennsylvania. He says last month's terrorist attack in California drove a lot of new customers his way.
After San Bernardino, our business went up probably 50% just because of people being at a Christmas party and being shot. That makes people worry.
And Lamplew says ISIS-inspired attacks aren't the only thing gun buyers fear. They're also worried that a government crackdown could make it harder to buy guns in the future.
See, the two things, they're scared and need to protect themselves, or they're afraid that they're going to take it from them. There's the two things that drive our business.
Since the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School 3 years ago, President Obama has spoken out repeatedly about his desire to make it harder for dangerous people to get their hands on guns. Dudley Brown of the National Association for Gun Rights says each time the president does so, cash registers start ringing at gun shops around the country.
Yes, he is a good gun salesman.
American gun makers churned out nearly 11 million guns in the year after Sandy Hook. That's twice as many as they made 3 years earlier. The U.S. now has twice as many guns per capita as it did in the late 1960s. Harvard researcher Deborah Azrael says there are about 300 million guns in all.
There's a gun for every man, woman, and child, more or less.
But that doesn't mean every man, woman, and child has one. Surveys suggest only about a third of American households have a gun these days, down from nearly half in the late 1970s. Researchers say a decline in hunting is partly responsible for that drop. Guns are increasingly concentrated in a shrinking number of households, and Azrael says statistical evidence makes it clear the remaining gun owners are not any safer.
Where access to guns is higher, more people die by suicide, more people die by homicide, and more people die from unintentional injuries.
Indeed, the danger from suicide is 2.5 to 5 times higher in households with a gun. The gun show promoter, John Lamploop, says that's not stopping people from stocking up.
We've seen an increase in people that have never owned a gun. Right now it's a protection thing, because we all know you can call the police and 14 minutes later they get there. Well, these guys in 14 minutes can put down a lot of people.
Lamploop is hosting a gun show this weekend near Allentown, Pennsylvania. He's expecting a big crowd.
So, as we set out this year to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
I wanted to bring Janelle Ross in as well, a reporter for the Washington Post blog, The Fix. Janelle, you have a piece headlined, "Why Aren't We Calling the Oregon Occupiers Terrorists?" And you start by saying, as of Sunday afternoon, the Washington Post called them occupiers. The New York Times opted for armed activists and militiamen. The Associated Press put the situation this way. A family previously involved in a showdown with the federal government has occupied a building at a national wildlife refuge in Oregon and is asking militia members to join them. Take it from there. You're talking about disparate coverage of different kinds of groups.
I think so. I think the point, I suppose, that I was trying to make or highlight was just the sort of slow and very deliberate, careful pace at which it seems that we often move in our public discussions of these sorts of events, from describing individuals such as the group that are occupying this facility in Oregon as sort of principled individuals who are there to support a specific cause. And although they, in some cases, have come to the facility armed, and in the case of Ammon Bundy, has said directly that while they are not looking for a violent confrontation, they are prepared to die there. This certainly is an indicator that some violence could occur. And there's, it seems, a real effort to be very, very careful about how their actions themselves and what they are doing right now are described. The same certainly can't be said about the way, for instance, that coverage of various protests related to race and policing have been covered, or the fairly rapid way in which the activities of, say, a group or subset of people who may have been involved in rioting in those cases gets sort of mushrooms out and becomes the way that the entire group is described. In fact, I'm sure you, as well as many viewers, have seen, you know, the sort of active conflation of protesters with rioters and looters and descriptions of them as thugs, et cetera. And a threat to entire cities and so on and so forth. And it's certainly, in light of that, very hard to imagine that the same kind of deliberate, slow, careful, methodical use of language would happen were there a group of, say, black protesters who had decided to take over a courthouse while armed and threatening to fight to the death. It's very hard to imagine.
Janelle, I wanted to play this for you. On Sunday, CNN law enforcement analyst Art Roderick said the militants were being treated differently than Black Lives Matter protesters because, quote, they're not looting anything. Roderick made the remarks in an interview when he was being interviewed by CNN host Brian Stelter. This is Brian first.
You know it's going to become politicized. And we've already heard from activists online, many of them, I've been reading from them all morning, to say if these were Black Lives Matter protesters or if these were peaceful Muslim Americans, they'd be treated very differently by law enforcement. Do you think there's truth to that argument?
We're not talking about—I think you had mentioned it in the opening, because this is a very rural area. It is out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. What are they actually doing? They're not destroying property. They're not looting anything. Right, exactly.
So there you have CNN law enforcement analyst Art Roderick. Your response, Janelle Ross?
My response to his opinion is not really necessary. I can only point out the obvious difference in what he said. I think that all Americans who, have been paying attention to the news over the last 12 months are aware that there were, in fact, protests and there were, in fact, some looters in Ferguson and in Baltimore. Or rioters. But there was also no reticence at all about describing those individuals that engaged in violent activities as rioters or as looters. And in fact, what you saw is people describing the entire groups of people who came for peaceful protests who were not armed and were being described in all sorts of ways, including as straight-up criminals and thugs, because of who they are, not because of what they were actively doing, even though much of this was caught on tape. And in this case, I think that while it is certainly true, factually, that these individuals are occupying a space in a rural area where there is little in the way of built infrastructure to destroy, even if that was what they were inclined to do, it is worth noting that these individuals have arrived armed, have said repeatedly that they are prepared to essentially fight to the death and, in fact, are seeking an overthrow or rather an end to federal government authority in specific areas or, in this case, over specific pieces of land. That is a whole and altogether different thing than protesting and saying that you would like to see the justice system function in a different way.
Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, talk about how media coverage influences how different groups are treated.
Well, I'm not sure I can—I don't know if I really want to compare the different groups. I do want to speak to the issue of terrorism, if I could, for a moment. There's no doubt that there's been an enormous amount of terrorism over the years that has emanated from the radical right in our country. You know, the most spectacular incident, of course, was the Oklahoma City bombing carried out by people who had a hatred of the federal government and felt that it was overreaching. And since that time, there have probably been 100 different plots involving efforts to kill federal officials, poison water supplies, and all of that. So the Bundys come out of a milieu where there has been an enormous amount of terrorism. So I understand exactly why Janelle would want to kind of describe this as a terrorist incident. You know, there's been no violence yet, but you can imagine something far worse happening from fanatics like this. I think these people have been described by the media as fanatics, as zealots. There has been, I think, some reluctance to call them terrorists. I'm not sure why. We certainly wouldn't call the rioters in or the people involved in a disturbance in Ferguson or Baltimore, wouldn't call them terrorists, but we would be very quick to, I think, condemn them. And I'm not I think people have been relatively quick, of course, to condemn the Bundys. Some, I mean, really quite, you know, I don't want to point fingers, but, you know, Sean Hannity, many Republican politicians originally portrayed the Bundys as heroic. Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Trump, Rand Paul all talked about how, you know, the Bundys were standing tall against the man. And that type of portraying them as heroes, I think, I think they should be held accountable for those kinds of that kind of encouragement that they've given them.
Of course, you contrast this, how the protesters here are being dealt with, to 1985, Janelle, to Philadelphia, when the Philadelphia police bombed the MOVE house, killing 11 people, actually dropped a bomb on their house. 11 people killed, 5 of them were children.
That is true. I think, of course, as Mr. Cohen said, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to make direct comparisons between groups and events and responses. There are always variables on the ground, certainly not the least of which in this case is the sort of urban versus rural setting. But there is, it seems at least, a sort of clear difference in the escalation of language and, or as Mr. Cohen pointed out, some real differences in the way that members of the media, but also the public, seem to think about and understand these individuals who are involved in different incidents. And it seems largely to be based on who they are rather than their cause or even more specifically what they're actually doing or not doing on the ground. And I would just come back to, all you have to do is look closely at specifically what Ayman Bundy has said about their goals and aims in Oregon and what they are prepared to do, and the fact that these occupiers have come to this space. They certainly have a right to assemble. They have a right to protest. This is the United States. That is certainly true. But to occupy a building is perhaps a different thing. It is not exactly the same as a protest. And further, to occupy a building while armed and to, in essence, invite a confrontation and say that it's going to end in violence is an entirely different thing. And there seems to be some sort of, I guess there are certainly some people who view, they may agree with the sort of underlying principles of their reason for gathering or occupying this space, but they have ascribe to that a whole series of very principled ideas and labels, which is noteworthy because it certainly affects both the way that these issues are covered, but also, I think, the way that law enforcement feels it is appropriate to respond or how the public will react to law enforcement's response.
The first thing we're going to do to, I think, stop racism is stop focusing on racism.
There are a growing number of studies documenting the power of unconscious bias and how these biases can perpetuate stereotypes and segregation. Unconscious biases affect nearly every element of society, from school discipline to job prospects and promotions. But one place where unconscious bias can have the most dramatic results is in healthcare. Dana Bowen-Mathieu, a professor at the University of Colorado Law School and the Colorado School of Public Health, calculates that over 84,000 men and women of color die each year due to health disparities, largely because of unconscious biases. Professor Matthew's latest book is Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare, and I'm very pleased that she joins us today. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. All right, Dana, so 84,000 people, that is a huge number. How did you come to that number when you were researching these health disparities between whites and minorities?
Well, I was very lucky because others had come to that number before I did. And so what I was able to do is look at some of the research that many others before me had done, and I realized, God, it's not a society where people are racist anymore that's causing these deaths. It's not just express racism, but it is unconscious and unintentional racism that could cause such a big number. It shocked me when I first read it.
So this is a number that has been out there in the scholarship.
Yes, it's been out there, as well as numbers about how expensive unconscious bias and racism in medicine is. Billions of dollars a year due to these needless deaths that could be prevented if we just address the discrimination.
So let's start with, clearly this is happening over at various points along the healthcare delivery system. I imagine it happens starting with where somebody lives, their neighborhood, the hospital they go to, the doctor they visit or don't visit. Where does it begin in your mind?
So that's a really insightful question, because many people think that healthcare disparities and inequality happens just because people don't get to the doctor. And the point of this book is to say, no, it's much bigger than that. And in some ways, it's even smaller than that. So there's this thing called the social determinants of health. Where I live, where I work, where I play, if it's unsafe, I'm unhealthy. If I don't have access to good food, I'm unhealthy. If I can't get a good job to buy good food for my children, I'm unhealthy. So it starts where I live and I work and I play. But then this book is about a much more narrow area, and that is discrimination in the clinical encounter, where that discrimination also causes unhealthy outcomes disproportionately for people of color as compared to whites.
Okay, so where does the discrimination in the clinical encounter, as you say, where does that start?
In perceptions. So the organization of this book is to say that there are six different places, and they start with people's perceptions. So let me just tell you a story. When I was, I'd say about 9 years old, I was on the playground, and a little girl made very clear why she wasn't going to play with me. That's the first time I ever heard anybody use the N-word, right?
Nigga!
And that is called express bias. Like, I had no question in my mind why she didn't want to play with me. Explicit bias. On the other hand, that experience left me with some perceptions. It left everybody else on the playground with perceptions about me, about people of my race, and they carry that forward in their unconscious minds. So when the doctor walks into the clinical room, that doctor has had experiences like my playground experiences. And so when he or she looks at me, an African-American woman, those perceptions are the beginning of implicit bias.
I mean, I know, I think Randall Kennedy has written about the fact that the N-word is not simply a symptom of racism. It's also a vehicle for racism. It actually creates negative mindsets in people who hear it. Doctors themselves are also susceptible to those mindsets, you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the dirty little secret is that nurses and pharmacists and even patients are susceptible to those as well. And all of that creates inequality in our healthcare system.
So what's an example? Somebody's sick. They have a condition that might be a common medical condition. They go to a doctor. Where does this sort of bias start really manifesting?
So let's talk about the perceptions. That's the first mechanism that we're talking about. So you might have a white doctor walk into a room and see an elderly African-American woman. Because of experiences like my playground experience, that doctor will say to himself, I know that this woman does not have the resources. I perceive that she may exaggerate her complaints. I perceive that she is not a compliant, a kind, a warm, a smart, a knowledgeable person. We have empirical data to show that those perceptions actually travel into the examination room with doctors even before the clinical encounter.
So you mentioned one thing, that she tends to complain too much.
Sure.
This is a common sort of a expression of bias. Is that,
oh, my goodness, is it ever. One of the interviews that I did was with a fourth-year medical student at Harvard University. And she told me stories of how her attendings on rounds would tell her to watch out for elderly Hispanic women, because Hispanic women, if you could see me, I'm using air quotes, Hispanic women tend to exaggerate their claims. Otherwise, they think they might be wasting your time. Usually, the attendings would say, what's really bothering them is problems with their kids or problems with their money, but they exaggerate complaints. Now, that's a perception that not only the attending held, but was transferring to his or her students who are going to become future doctors. Now, Arun, what does that do to the interaction medically between that Hispanic patient and that physician? It changes the quality of the medical care that's actually going to be delivered. And I argue that is a source of inequality in health outcomes.
I'm Arun Venugopal, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Dana Bowen-Mathieu, the author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. So Dana, let's talk more about, I guess, doctors. Did you speak to a number of doctors while doing your research about your findings? Are they sympathetic to this, or do they push back?
Well, both. I had an experience that really made it very easy for me to speak to doctors, and that was I was actually at a conference in East Africa where there were about 150 doctors that I had as captives, and all I had to do was get them to sign permission slips, and they interviewed with me. So what I found was really interesting. I said that these perceptions were the first of the bias mechanisms. There are six in total in this model that I'm suggesting. So one of the things I asked doctors about a lot was their treatment decisions. That's a fifth mechanism. I'd say to them, do you experience or do you think you are a victim of implicit bias when you make treatment decisions? Well, the pushback, to answer your question, was pretty vigorous. No, not me. I've read about it. There are others who have this problem, but not in my practice. So after that discussion, I would reveal some of the data. If you're a pediatrician, we can reveal the data that African-American students or patients who have a high prevalence of asthma have a low prevalence of access to steroids. I could reveal the data that if you are an OBGYN, women who have breast cancer and are of color get diagnosed much later, and the surprise on their face was really revealing. What it revealed to me, Arun, was that these are not people that are racist and want to treat patients differently. They don't want to treat people with discrimination. But that's the insidiousness, if you will, of implicit bias. It happens without you realizing that it's happening.
Your husband is a heart surgeon, am I right?
Yes, he is.
Was your research about this, about implicit bias, was a surprise to him?
So it was a very interesting experiment that I did to interview both he and his partners. Because he's the only person of color in his group. And one of the things that was very interesting was to try and pair white and black patients that they had both seen to see if my third and fourth mechanisms were true in his cardiac practice.
So and your third and fourth were?
Communication on the patient side and communication on the physician side. So to see if implicit bias infected communication on the patient and physician side for a mixed race practice with mixed race patients. Following me?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting to see that on the part of my husband, who's an African-American physician, he was very, very familiar with and transparent about implicit bias, both understanding that he had them and that he had experienced them. So one of the funniest stories that I got interviewing him and his practice was the fact that when he is asked to do surgery on a wealthy white family patient, he gets the interview. Where did you go to medical school? How many of these cases have you done? Do you know this very well-named person in this very well-named place and how they do this surgery? And his answer is, if I see too much of this, I just send them right down the street to my white partner, and he doesn't get the interview.
Really?
His face gives him the credibility. He doesn't need the interview. So yes, he experienced it from patients, and that's one of the things that I talk about in this book, that patients can have implicit biases also, just like physicians can. Now, on the other hand, some of the interesting things that I found about doctors' implicit biases, even those who had very, very good intentions. So here's the really important nugget. Implicit biases can be absolutely contradictory to your express preferences to be egalitarian. So you want to be fair. You want to be a good person. You want to treat people equally. But you don't acknowledge or know that you have implicit biases. One of the researchers at Wayne State calls that averse racism. Averse racism, because I'm averse to racism, but I have it and don't realize it and therefore don't treat it. Those tend to be the physicians that minority patients react most negatively to. It's really ironic.
So there's a real dissonance between their, their conscious sort of presentation and the fact that they still have these, deep down, these deep-seated sort of biases.
Yeah. And not only is there a dissonance, but that, again, is what patients of color pick up most vigorously. Like, they'd almost rather, at least in the interviews, if you take the quantitative data, they'd almost rather deal with an express frank bigot, right? I know where you're coming from. You know where you're coming from. All right, we all understand what the playing field
you
looks
people.
Like. You people. We gotcha, you know? But when dealing with somebody who expressly portends to be an egalitarian, a progressive, a liberal, and yet has not attended to their implicit biases, that reduces patient satisfaction and the quality of their experience significantly.
This the city of Chicago. Chicago.
Just how much did Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel know about the police shooting death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, and when did he know it? The black teen was killed late in 2014, but police dash cam video wasn't made public until more than a year later. And now, thousands of emails released late last week following a public records request, they shed more light on that question of what Emanuel knew. Michael Tarm is with the AP and joins us from Chicago. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So first of all, can you give us just briefly a sense as to what's in these emails? What do they tell us?
There's really no smoking gun, which was what, as reporters, we were looking for. No email where we learn clearly what Emanuel knew and when he knew it about the shooting. What we do learn is that his close advisors understood within really a few weeks after the Laquan McDonald shooting in 2014 that this case could really be politically explosive. They clearly worried about the impact of the video, the scrutiny it would draw. The emails also show that the mayor's office coordinated with police, with a supposedly independent body that's responsible for investigating police. They sought to closely coordinate their public response to this shooting. And that coordination clearly ran counter to city assurances that the investigative agency was completely independent.
Right. So tell us a little bit more about this coordination, because as you mentioned, the independent body that investigates police shootings was part of all this, these big email chains. That does seem kind of unusual, even if coordination between the mayor's office and the police doesn't necessarily feel surprising.
It does raise real questions. The mayor's office has long asserted that this body, although it is a city body, it is completely independent. One example in the emails that we reviewed, the head of the agency actually sent the city lawyers an email saying, look, if you need witness interview transcripts as you negotiate on a lawsuit with the family of the boy that was killed, if it's helpful, we can send those on. That really raises questions about appropriateness and about distance the city was supposed to keep and the agency was supposed to keep.
Yeah. Well, and what's really surprising to me, or eye-opening, I should say, is you report that this coordination begins fairly soon after the actual shooting death of Laquan McDonald. I mean, you've got emails from the end of 2014 all the way through much of 2015. And, I mean, by July, you report that the emails show that top aides in Rahm Emanuel's administration were really worried about the perception of a cover-up. I mean, you quote an email from Emanuel aide Vance Henry, who says, you know, he's talking about media reports in places like the Chicago Sun-Times, and he says that there's a growing interest in the McDonald incident, and it, quote, has not worked in our favor and is helping to stir the pot. Now, emails like that, I mean, it's hard for them to not give the impression that Rahm Emanuel's office was more worried about optics than actually about seeking justice in this case.
They understood very, very quickly that they had a hot potato here on their hands. And as the months went on, as they were fighting the release of the video, it became clearer and clearer to them that this thing could blow up in their faces. And in March of 2015, lawyers for the family wrote to the city, and they had recently seen the video. And the lawyers made clear to the city that this video is shocking. They clearly use that knowledge to put a little pressure on the city. But the city was clearly viewing all this with increasing alarm.
Right. They're right about that, because obviously the entire nation has been talking about this case since that video was publicly released. But I'm curious, given all that you said, how are the people of Chicago reacting to the release of these emails?
Well, you know, they did release these emails on New Year's Eve, and that also raised some eyebrows. So people, I think, are still sort of mulling it over and trying to understand what the implications are. And Emanuel clearly has seen his popularity plummet. Some of his harshest critics are screaming, cover up, and others are saying that at the very least he displayed a real tin ear here. But he's also known as a survivor, and many political observers say it's unlikely that he will wave the white flag and step down. He's just not that kind of guy.
But on the other hand, though, I'm seeing that, you know, as you know, there have been calls for him to step down for over a month now. But now there's also a Democratic state lawmaker in Illinois who's pushing for legislation that would give voters the chance to recall Emanuel. Is that right?
Yes, there is a push in the legislature for giving citizens the right to withdraw mayors. It's hard to know how quickly that will be enacted and whether or not there would be enough of a groundswell here in Chicago to recall him.
Well, Michael Tarm covers federal and legal affairs for the Associated Press in Chicago. Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This the city of Chicago. Chicago.
Let's turn now to Chicago, where a group of African-American men have begun receiving checks for $100,000 each. That money is compensation for the 57 men who survived torture at the hands of a Chicago police commander and his officers. But activists say that's not the final chapter in this story about race and police brutality. From member station WBEZ in Chicago, Natalie Moore reports.
In 1983, police shoved a shotgun in Daryl Cannon's mouth. He was tortured into confessing a crime he didn't commit. Cannon received life in prison but was exonerated in 2004. Since his release, he's advocated for reparations.
No black man has ever received reparations for having been tortured at the hands of white police officers.
In May, the Chicago City Council approved a reparations package. And today, the city says reparations are important to bring closure to families. Men like Daryl Cannon suffered because of John Burge, a police commander who directed his detectives to nearly suffocate, shock, and otherwise abuse hundreds of black suspects arrested from 1972 until 1991. He was fired in the 1990s and in 2011 served 4.5 years in prison, not for the torture, but for lying under oath about the torture. He was released last year. Cannon claims there are still men behind bars who Burge tortured.
There's many steps yet to be taken in this matter before any of us can be happy.
Activists have fought for justice for decades and even took their cause to the United Nations. Today, the legacy of torture survivors reverberates in Chicago as a new crop of young activists take on police violence with the same passion. As one of the lawyers who fought for reparations, Joey Mogul sees a connection between past and present.
Meanwhile, in this moment, after the Laquan McDonald video has come out, and we've seen both the video and the cover-up, people are traumatized in this city.
The U.S. Department of Justice is now investigating charges of abuse by Chicago police. The reparations package also calls for a public torture memorial in Chicago. Alice Kim is an organizer.
We need to make sure that this history is recorded and documented, that people know that it happened. People need to know about the struggle of the survivors.
And as for Daryl Cannon, he received a check, which he says is not enough for what he suffered. He says he'll celebrate, though, by riding his new motorcycle around City Hall in a victory lap. For NPR News, I'm Natalie Moore in Chicago.
This the city of Chicago. Chicago.
Claims of racism tonight within the Chicago Fire Department and a call for the Justice Department to investigate. Tonight we're hearing from African-American firefighters who are calling for the removal of the fire commissioner, Jose Santiago. Eyewitness News reporter Leah Hope has the story.
It is rare that a firefighter would speak against the department, but today, some representing Chicago's African-American firefighters and paramedics make some disturbing allegations.
We have systemic racism within the Chicago Fire Department.
They want the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate hiring and promotion in the department, and they want the fire commissioner out.
We've met with him for 5 years. The league has met with him. We've had all kinds of discussions with him. He says one thing, he does something absolutely different.
Today, Mayor Emanuel noted changes to the Chicago Fire Department that have been made to address past injustices in hiring. And he stands behind Commissioner Santiago.
Jose Santiago did a tremendous job at OEMC and tremendous job as leading the, as not only a firefighter, but leading the firefighters department.
Despite African Americans going through the academy after class action lawsuits were settled, those here today allege problems exist.
Despite my degrees, despite my work history and also my experience, I still found myself being demoted and not treated fairly.
It is phenomenal to be able to serve someone at the time they're needed. There's a 911 call. Whenever they call, we answer. Well, here's a 911 call we have.
A recent incident, they say, was how a station with a majority of African-American firefighters was treated after concerns about bed bugs. We've learned new beds were delivered today as the league held its press conference.
We're not asking for a handout. We're just asking for equality.
Leah Hope, ABC 7 Eyewitness News.
And the mayor and the fire commissioner emphasize equal treatment and equal opportunity are critically important. The mayor also said that the Department of Justice already oversees the fire department's promotions testing.
Since you're a big Canada fan,
we encounter racism every single day. Some of the worst racists carry a gun, and they carry a badge authorized by you, Commissioner Paulson, to do the work. We need you to confront racism in the ranks.
Tough words there, but when it comes to relations between Indigenous people in Canada and its police, there have been tough times. That was Doug Kelly, Grand Chief of BC's Stalo Tribal Council, speaking to a crowd of hundreds at an Assembly of First Nations meeting in Quebec last month. Also in attendance that day was RCMP Commissioner Bob Paulson.
I hear what you say. I understand that there are racists in my police force. I don't want them to be in my police force. I would encourage you all, though, to have confidence in the processes that exist, up to and including calling me if you are having a problem with a racist in your jurisdiction or any other problem.
It was the first time the commissioner had attended such an AFN gathering, which was a welcome sign in itself to many, including National Chief Perry Bellegarde. And while the commissioner's comments that day would spark complaints from his own officers' association, his words were momentous for what they were. Frank, open talk about racism and police. With an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women on the horizon and forces from Quebec to BC coming under fire for alleged racist behavior, it's a discussion that seems long overdue. We have two guests here to talk more about racism in Canada's police forces. Keith Hobbs is the mayor of Thunder Bay, Ontario, where he was also a police officer for more than 30 years. He's in Thunder Bay. And Larry Hay was an RCMP officer for 19 years and then chief of police for the Tiendanaga Mohawk Nation. He is currently a private investigator. We reached him at home on the Tiendanaga Mohawk territory. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Connie.
So, Keith, can I begin with you? As a former police officer, what do you think when you hear Chief Doug Kelly say that, you know, his people face racist police?
You know, every segment of society faces racism, and I defy anybody to say that there's not racism in every community in this country and in the world. You see what's going on in the Middle East. My heritage, my family, my mother's family lost 12 people to the Holocaust. So we know firsthand about racism and those issues. But in policing, it's there. Commissioner Paulson said is absolutely true, but it's everywhere, and we need to take it head on, not just with police, but in the private sector as well.
Larry Hay, in your 19 years as an RCMP officer, did you encounter racism in your job?
Yes, certainly. And if I might, I'd like to respond to Commissioner Paulson's remarks and just let you know that my first reaction was that his response was very similar to Commissioner Fantino's remarks about boiling it down to a few bad apples. He was responding to remarks that I had made saying that RCMP and other Canadian police services were racist organizations. And I ultimately ended up losing my job over that comment. But they boil it down, it seems, to a few bad apples, when in fact it's systemic racism that's the bigger picture.
Can you give us an example of the kind of racism that you experienced as an RCMP officer?
I can. Certainly, it first really reared its ugly head in 1990 during the OCA crisis. Tensions were very high. I mean, not just in policing, but certainly around the country. But some of the comments that I heard really gave me pause to think.
What did people say?
Things like, you know, let's go in there and kill those effing Mohawks. Let's just go in there with tanks. Let's kill them all. Like, it's sort of half said in jest, but you know that there's an underlying current of a racist attitude that's often hard to identify unless there are crises like that.
Hmm. Keith Hobbs, you said recently that in your time as a police officer that you also made your share of racist comments. How would you describe your views at that time?
Well, absolutely I did. And, you know, until we admit that we're all at fault here, things will never get fixed. And, you know, as a watch commander, probably about 90%, and I'm not exaggerating, of the people that we incarcerated were Aboriginal people. And I think it's out of a sense of frustration. And in 1997, Thunder Bay identified to our police services board what was happening with Aboriginal people, Indigenous people in Thunder Bay, and the rates of alcohol and suicide and things like that. And nothing was really done. And I think it was just out of ignorance that I made those comments and other officers made those comments. Until you learn about the treaties, the residential schools, the struggles. My first two trips as mayor up to northern communities, I flew into northern communities and saw conditions firsthand and talked to the band counselors and the chiefs and got an education. And I'm not so ignorant now. And we're doing a lot in Thunder Bay to try and bridge a gap and make this an inclusive society. And that's what other communities need to do. And
So, Larry, you mentioned your own personal experience in terms of making comments about racism in the police force in 2007. What did you say?
So the comments that were made to that Aboriginal reporter We're at a time when there were very high tensions. I and my officers of the Tandanega Police Service were policing a very volatile situation. We had asked a number of times, according to our operational agreement with the local OPP detachment, that these officers, the OPP officers, not come into the protest site because it was stirring up the occupiers. And there were about 200 or 300 of them at the time that we had been successfully managing for about 3 weeks. And this continually happened. There was high tension. I made those remarks when I was asked by this reporter, is there racism in policing? And of course, just like Keith has said this morning, yeah, absolutely there is. Now, to what extent? In my view, this systemic racism always seems to come up whenever there's tensions between Aboriginal groups and mainstream Canadian society. And you know, we saw that in the Ipperwash recommendations when Justice Lyndon said, you know, these are very emotional times for Aboriginal people. Police need to be responsive and understand much more deeply what's going on and come at it with a very a much more intelligent attitude instead of bringing out the military right off the bat, setting up sniper teams. All of that seems to be an overreaction, a disproportionate use of violence.
In 2007, when you were speaking to that reporter, you said there is racism within the OPP.
No, I said there was racism in the RCMP, the Sûreté du Québec, as well as the OPP, especially the OPP, because I had the most experience with racism in dealing with the Ontario Provincial Police at the time.
How did they react to your comments?
Well, it was an overreaction, actually, on the part of Julian Fantino, the commissioner of the day, who immediately suspended me without any charge or infraction. Or there's no mechanism for him to do what he actually did.
So his chief of police for Tiendanaga, Julian Fantino, had some control over your position at the time?
I think he assumed control. He actually abused the agreement. He operated contrary to the agreement when he withdrew funding, the provincial portion of my funding, and thereby, of course, removing my appointment as the chief of police for my remarks. And as I said earlier, his response to those remarks were to simply say, you know what, if you've got a complaint about an individual officer, bring it forward. Well, that's not what my comments were about.
So what exactly do you mean when you talk about this being a systemic problem within police forces?
I think it's, What I would like to say is that what happens in protest situations where tensions are high, that's where you see these comments seeping out. We had that happen in Tiendanega in 2007 and 2008 after I had left the service. where there was just this disproportionate use of force. I don't know that the public realizes how close we came to having another fatality, similar to the one that happened in 1995 at Ipperwash with Mr. Dudley George, who was an unarmed protester that was shot and killed by the OPP back then. We came desperately close to that.
Keith Hobbs, do you see the issue of racism in police forces as a systemic problem as well?
I think that it's just it's an education problem is what it is. And I've said this before, I've said it publicly, that you know, the province of Ontario and the feds need to really step up to the plate on this issue. And the curriculum in the schools, you know, talking about the treaties, talking about residential schools, you know, talking about educating yourself is sorely, sorely lacking. And that goes for police services as well. Officers, part of their curriculum now, I know at the Ontario Police College, is multiculturalism and learning about Indigenous people. And that needs to really be pushed in a big way, more so than it even is now.
Okay, I want to bring another guest into the conversation. Susan Roy is a professor of history at the University of Waterloo, who has specialized in the history of Indigenous and non-Indigenous relationships in Canada. She's in our Toronto studio. Hello.
Good morning, Connie.
So, Susan, we've just heard Larry Hay say that he believes this is a systemic issue, that it has more to do with a flawed system as opposed to a few bad apples. Can you give us some historical context to this tense relationship between police and Indigenous communities?
Sure. It's clear that Indigenous communities in the RCMP have a long and sometimes very antagonistic historical relationship. So Parliament established the Northwest Mounted Police first in 1873 as a way to pacify and control. Their intent was to pacify and control the Prairie West before the influx of white settlement.
So this has been a very long relationship
So this was a way to bring in Western forms of law and order that, of course, you know, denies the fact that Indigenous communities in that region had very complex systems of governance and justice. So having a police force in the West also allowed for the entry of other kinds of colonial agents, such as missionaries, surveyors, government officials, Indian agents, and settlers.
Do you see, but it's no different than white police officers jacking up black men and feeling between their legs, or the case that was reported not long ago, I think the case was Philadelphia, where a white female police officer squeezed and was handling and crushing the testicles of a black male. You see, so this obsession from the days of lynching and castration to the present, we can say the present being today in the big football games, the preoccupation with black male genitalia and black testicles in particular, because that is the perceived threat.
I am not a polished speaker, but I have a heart. I have a heart for Maine and for Maine people.
And that is Maine Governor Paul LePage speaking out after comments he made earlier this week created a controversy. LePage apologized, but he also stood by much of what he said. Our Danielle Waugh live in Augusta with the details. Danielle?
Well, Brian, Governor LePage has come under fire for saying that drug dealers are coming to Maine and impregnating white women. Today he insisted that those comments were not about race.
I was going impromptu and my brain didn't catch up to my mouth.
Governor LePage is apologizing for the way he spoke about Maine's drug epidemic at a town hall meeting Wednesday night.
It was a slip of the tongue.
Here are the comments some are calling racist.
These are guys of the name D-Money, Smoothie, Shifty, these type of guys that come from Connecticut, New York. They come up here, they sell their heroin, then they go back home. Incidentally, half the time they impregnate a young white girl before they leave.
LePage is now saying he meant to say Maine women, not white women.
I apologize to all the Maine women.
We asked if he should also apologize to the black community for referencing black men arrested for drug trafficking and not the white criminals. This was his response.
It was an inappropriate comment, and your comment, ma'am, is inappropriate because I didn't say anything about black.
Didn't you say D-Money, Swifty, Smoothie, aren't those?
Yeah. What are they, black? I don't know who they are. I just read the names.
It shows what he's really thinking when he's not consciously filtering what he's saying.
As his comments receive widespread condemnation, LePage spent most of his press conference admonishing the media.
Shame on you. Shame, shame, shame.
Saying reporters are too focused on one slip of the tongue and not paying enough attention to the drug crisis.
Is I want the drug dealers to know I'm after them.
And while LePage criticized the media and even suggested the ways that they should be covering the drug epidemic, he also admitted that he very rarely reads the news. Live in Augusta, Maine, Danielle Waugh, NECN.
Context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 9th, 2016. So I have been told. Update that I got on my Facebook page just within the last few minutes. There was a change of venue for the memorial for Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. This is reportedly from Anthony Browder. He's been a guest on the program before, and Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's sister. The family of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing has announced the venue for her memorial has been changed. It will no longer be held at Howard University. It will be held January 23rd, 2016, from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at the historic Metropolitan AME Church. The address is 1518 M Street. Northwest. This is in Washington, D.C. Free parking will be available in the PMI garage down the block from the church. The memorial service will be live streamed and live broadcast from WPFW 89.3 FM. And you can get this online at WPFWFM.org. This information is on my Facebook page. The family has also asked, please do not send flowers or cards to Dr. Welsing's office, 7603 Georgia Avenue, or her home. In lieu of flowers, the family is kindly requesting contributions be made to the Cress Welsing Love Fund. Details will be available next week. So this memorial, this will be taking place not next weekend, but 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today, this will be happening January 23rd. I'll probably say it a few more times on the program between now and then. And again, it is posted on my Facebook page, Black Self-Respect. With that, this is our compensatory call-in. Folks would like to participate. If you have any views you would like to share, observations from the past 7 weeks, certainly any of the news clips, items that were played at the beginning of the program or anything else that you happen to see in your own research, feel free to chime in. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. A couple quick thoughts. I will get in before I nab some of the folks who called in. Number one, the piece that played, I guess, midway through, it was about the report, the study on racism, white supremacy in healthcare and the disastrous impact that this has on the health They were saying people of color, and I think it should be emphasized, black patients. There are many, many reports. We here at the COWS have done many, many programs on how racism, white supremacy is manifest in this area, and even some things that you can try to do to combat that form of white terrorism. But I thought it was interesting because the female who wrote the book, even though it was a black female author, this insistence perpetuating the belief that this is unconscious bias. I think that was the word that was used. Unconscious bias. You have these perceptions, these stereotypes that, you know, are just in your brain. You don't even know that they're there. You say that you're all about, you know, being an egalitarian and I'm for everybody. I'm going to, quote unquote, treat people fairly. But then, bammo, the black people end up getting all these disastrous consequences where they're just not treated the same way that you would treat a white patient. And I say that that is hogwash. She is VGQ. She certainly is guaranteed to have her opinion. But just that entire trope, that entire notion of pushing that all of this is the result of ignorant white people, because I think you heard that in a lot of the clips, it's just nonsense. And that's whether you go medical apartheid, Harriet Washington, that's whether you go the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks, that's whether it's Dorothy Roberts killing the black body, Fatal Invention. I mean, we have done a lot of books, and even the first book that actually came to my mind was Dr. John Hoberman, who is a white man. He's been on this program a couple times. His, I think, most recent book, it's called Black and Blues, where one of the core themes in the book is that, okay, right, you've done all of these documentaries and books, you got, you know, research piled to the ceiling. Oh my gosh, we got all this, what they call disparate healthcare results. We got all of this, and oh my, black patients, you know, really struggle. They don't get the same opportunity to get painkillers and just all of this. It's just terrible. They're more likely to have amputations. Oh my God, the hand wringing. And he said, but you can't find any racists. That's the main theme of his book. You know, we talked about it on the program. And then you go and you talk to these people, mostly white doctors, mostly white healthcare providers, and you start to examine some of their worldviews. And he said that a lot of these people are overwhelmingly Republican. Not that I'm into the Republicans are racist and everybody else is not, but overly Republican, very what they call conservative in their views, looking at the people that they vote for, looking at some of the policies that they favor. Even going back, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she said in her final lecture at the Welsing Institute that she said, third-generation physician, she said in her training in medical school, she was taught that, you know, black people, you know, these niggers, they don't really respond to psychiatry. All you can do is, you know, just stick them on the side somewhere, maybe stuff some drugs in their mouth or whatever, just move them to the side. She said that's what she was taught. And we've had other black people who have come through and talked about the racist dogma that they have to accept, regurgitate, if you want to get that MD, get that piece of paper so you can go out and pay off those loans and hopefully make some money as a physician. That is not unconscious, that's not unintentional, that's not being ignorant or poorly educated, that's hogwash, that is deliberate war against black people. Call it what it is, medical apartheid should be on the horizon. You can add Vernelia Randall, Dying While Black, you can add that one as well. She was on the program with great information. And if I could give one more, the book An American Health Dilemma. Excellent book written by a black married couple. I think I mentioned it on the program yesterday, but you can add that one as well. This is not just accidental. We didn't know. Whoops, not at all. War against black people. The next comment I wanted to make sure I got in. When they talked about the Oregon occupiers, a lot of the commentary that I heard about that, they were minimized to being ignorant, stupid. I didn't hear anybody reference them as racists, even though one of the folks that's there, one of the white men, is a relative of Cliven Bundy. And the comments that he made when they had their last armed confrontation with federal authorities, where after some of this had calmed down and he took time and chatting it up with the media to say, well, let me tell you what I've learned about the Negro. I didn't hear anybody brand them as racist. I also thought it was significant in all of that. One of the reports that was shared on my Facebook page, I think it might have been Princess, it showed one of these white guys. They were out in their pickup truck and, you know, doing their standoff thing. And it had a big circle
and it had the initials BLM crossed out. So big circle, BLM written in the middle of the circle and then crossed out. And people saw them and were like, oh, wow, they're talking about Black Lives Matter. And I had read some other articles on this to just get more details on what was the nature of this conflict. And it seems that the whites in Oregon, at least the militia armed terrorists who have confiscated this federal property, their beef is with the federal government, but specifically with the Bureau of Land Management. These are the folks that they think are specifically causing the problem in Oregon. So I think that's who the BLM that they were referencing. But, you know, I've said for many years, I do not believe in coincidence. I think one of our listeners said that that's killing two birds with one stone. I do not think that that is, you know, just a total, oh, wow, look at that. What a coincidence. How about that? The initials of this group that we hate just happen to match this BLM group that white people have been gleefully labeling as terrorists and thugs and hooligans and looters and unemployed and the whole nine for, I don't know, a year and a half now, however long this has been going on. I thought there was one other thing I was going to get in, but I will save it for later. Again, the number to dial if you'd like to participate, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I did not include audio, even though I had it in the description. I did not include the audio. The officer, Brian Insignia, suspected race soldier who arrested Sandra Bland. They got the dash cam footage and the passerby who got the video footage. He was charged with perjury this week, and her family was talking about that and the nonsense of it all. Very similar to, not even suspected in my book, race soldier, race terrorist, John Burge in Chicago, who was never charged, he was never convicted for any of his terrorist acts against Black Chicago citizens. He just got convicted for perjury, looking very similar. And Mr. Insignia might not even be convicted for perjury in this case. Who knows? Anyway, that did happen this week. I did have it in the description, just didn't include the audio for it. With that, we'll get to the phone lines. If you could watch the background noise, that would be super appreciated. If you could remember that other folks on the line who would also like to share. So just you don't have to be quick, but, you know, just be mindful that there are other folks who want to talk so that you're not taking up too much time. And new rule, we do not do metaphors on the Saturday program. No metaphors on. This is exclusive to the compensatory call-in. No metaphors. Let's all work to be precise and accurate. Part of what we're supposed to be doing on this program is getting better with words, and I think all of us should be able to accurately, explicitly explain what it is we're talking about without having to rely exclusively, or even I would say heavily, on metaphors. I've just seen where, again, it ends up being a lot of confusion, and sometimes that can be a nice vehicle for beating up on Black people, which we should all be working to minimize. Black self-respect. I would also add, in that same vein, it is a metaphor, and I think it's name-calling, referencing other non-white people as puppets. I think it fits the same pattern of thinking of non-white people, particularly Black people, as non-humans. A puppet is not a person. The attention should be focused on the person that is controlling the strings, if you want to, you know, stick with that line of thinking. But we really should be redirecting attention on who is ultimately to blame for causing these problems. But that's just one to throw in. I would at minimum appreciate if folks could minimize using that word puppet to reference other non-white people on this program, simply because, as I said, it's name-calling at one level, it's a metaphor on another level, and it's just not focusing attention correctly on who is most to blame. With that, the folks that dialed in with a hand up, feel free to chime in. Should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers who's going to participate and all those who are listening to archives. I had a few observations I'd like to make. As part of my codification, I refuse to empathize with white drug addicts. You know, I grew up in the crack cocaine over the 80s and 90s. You know, three of my closest friends, one had a mother and one had a father who was on crack cocaine, and the other had both parents on it, and my father as well. So the comments that this guy made, white people, you know, all they would do was point and laugh in the 80s and 90s at black people. But now that it's them suffering from it, they have, some type of issue, I guess. First of all, you know, the drug problem, when it affected us, that was chemical warfare. This guy, Governor LePage, you already played what he said. I was going to, you know, mention it. This guy, I don't even have words for it. I mean, when this was us, exclusively, you know, the teenage pregnancy, 80s and 90s and all of that, and, you know, no one had anything to say. But now he has a lot to say, you know, against, seems like they're trying to blame black people for all the problems they're having up there. Chemical warfare again in Flint, Michigan. You didn't play, I don't think, anything about this. Another chocolate city with more than 50% black people. You know, they're drinking contaminated faucet water filled with lead. You know, lead is extremely dangerous to brain development, a la Freddie Gray. Suffered a lot of challenges because of his lead poisoning. And I can see that being a hotbed for a lot of problems to come in the future. Black self-respect, you know, sometimes I have to kick my own self for my lack of knowledge. I saw an article this week on a person named Victor Hugo Green, a black male who made Green Book for Negro Challenge Travelers. During the Jim Crow era and segregation, this book pointed out places where black people could stay, stop and be safe, get gas, use the restroom, hotel, park, beaches and parks that they could use and not be, you know, not be affected by racism, white supremacy. And I just wanted to commend him for that's a high level of black self-respect. As for the militant terrorists who took over the state building in Oregon, this is the second time under this administration I remember this happening. They're not called terrorists, of course. They're called occupiers. And from Israel, I know that an occupier is another name for a white person, and an occupation is another name for white supremacy. So I just wanted to keep that in mind. The part you played about the bias, implicit bias, I think it was called. Was that what it was called, Bogus?
Correct.
Yeah, Scotty Reed talks about that a lot. In my opinion, that's just another fancy fancy word to say white supremacy, racism. It has nothing to do with implicit bias. It has to do with racism, white supremacy. It's sort of like with that white privilege word, that phrase they like to kick around, has nothing to do with that. Lastly, Rahm Emanuel, I just would like for everyone to Google Israel training U.S. police, and now we see why they are trained in these counter-terrorist type of scenarios with the weaponry and things that they have. And Rahm Emanuel is a former Mossad agent, the people that's doing this training of the police. So it doesn't surprise me at all that Chicago has become the hotbed of this police racism, terrorism, because that's what his country's training them to do. And I'll beat my line.
Other folks have comments they want to make sure they get in.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello to you, Gus, the host, and to, you know, the callers and the listeners. Just want to say a couple of things. It was so funny, Thomas in New York just said Google about the U.S. Training the police, Israel training the U.S. police. And I did Google it, and I, you know, brought up, and it just made me think, though, that, you know, because it just seems like, even though we know things have been going on, it just seems like to me with Mike Brown, you just saw an uptick in this. And every time police come up with black people, they escalate the situation. And now you get, you know, you hear people, something happens, and you hear police say, well, we weren't trained to do this, we weren't trained to do that. And I sort of, I was like, you know, you weren't trained. Remember with the young man, Freddie Gray, that was killed, you know, in Baltimore, And I remember the one police said, Porter, I think the police did, whose trial was a hung jury. And I think part of his testimony was that, well, we weren't trained to, you know, put the perpetrators in seatbelts. And I remember I said to myself, I was like, you give tickets to people if you see people in their cars driving up down the street without seatbelts, but yet you weren't trained to put perpetrators into seatbelts. So when Thomas of New York says that, and as I Googled it, it made me think, it's like, oh, okay, to me now this explains some of what I'm looking at. As far as the implicit bias or the unintentional bias, you know, with doctors, years ago when I was younger, and I would go to the library, you know, and study and stuff like that, but I used to read medical journals. I'd be in books and I'd find an article. And I can remember, and I'm talking, when I'm talking about years ago, I'm talking about this was like in the 80s, so you're talking about 30 years ago. And I can remember reading one article, I think this was the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was about blacks and health coverage or health care. And this was back then when that article said, blacks, no matter what our economic standing was in society, poor, middle class, wealthy, we still were not getting the best of health care. We don't get health care comparable to what white people would get in, you know, the economic class. In other words, a poor white person could get better health care than a wealthy black person. So when I hear that, you know, her report today, I was just like, well, I've heard this. I don't necessarily know, like you said, this implicit bias because you try to act like, oh, no, racism has. I'm not racist. Oh, it's just something there. And then they even denied that. Remember, you know, like she was saying that, you know, doctors will say, oh, no, well, I have it in my practice, but it's not me. So I thought that I just remember as I was listening to that, I'm like, well, I can remember it. You know, read articles 30, 35, almost 40 years ago that was basically saying, you know, black people just aren't getting the best of health care. And I'll go out on a limb and say that, you know, if we got to stay up in this system, we won't get the best of health care because the racism is just, you know, it's just that deep. So I'm just not, you know, not surprised at all by you know, that report. And I guess it's good, though, that it's bad because, you know, we need to know. You know, it's painful because it's like a lot of things that we need to do or try to do to help ourselves because we know that the system is not going to do it. But, you know, that's all I wanted to say. If I have anything else, I'll unmute myself. And if I have anything else, I'll unmute myself. Thank you.
Any of the other folks who have a hand up, you have comments, feel free.
May I be heard okay?
If you could speak up a little bit, that would be helpful.
Oh. Is better?
That is better.
Yes? No? Okay. Well, even though you didn't play the Brian and Sinia thing, of course, you know, that was ridiculous perjury, but you know, it's not really over. The investigation that's going on now is finding out that the noose wasn't removed from her neck until 3 hours after she was found hanged. So they did that to show to make sure there was a libidity pattern. Also, she came in on a Friday, and they're finding out that on a Saturday that all communication with her was stopped. They wrote a bogus ticket and backdated it that made her ineligible for bail. So they're presuming that something happened on Saturday that they didn't want anyone around to bail her out. So she wasn't even eligible for bail because they wrote this bogus ticket saying she had a warrant out, didn't show up, and none of that's true. So, and then they told the family, they said, well, you know, you're the cause of it. You didn't bail her out. So they just, you know, they did that for the fun of it when they knew that they had backdated a bogus ticket until, for her arrest, and she wasn't eligible for bail at all. Also on this brand, Also, yes, they're not releasing the name of the drug. They say they treated her for her epilepsy, but they won't release the name of the drug. But Judge Duhon said that, you know, the only drug, they did a toxicology screen, and the only drug they found in her system was huge, huge, huge amounts of marijuana. So, you know, that begs the question, how did that happen? And, you know, and just so you know, another black woman who was in the jail had reported, and they tried to bury it, that they had slipped her something. They had drugged her. Her memory was faulty, but she assured that she was molested while she was in the jail. Now, if you mix Rohypnol, you know, the date rape drug, with huge amounts of marijuana, that's enough. That's enough to be a toxic and keep you from breathing right there. Those two together and, you know, goodly amounts will keep you from breathing. So maybe that's what happened. So that investigation is not over. It was just a show with the troopers last week, but they're still in a bit of trouble, and there's still other investigations going on. Also, somebody was talking about the... Why did he say that? Maybe not. But I just wanted to mention something that I noticed that was just shocking to me with the schools. Is that a lady, a black lady, they fired all of the black teachers, but they did hire one. She was there for a week, but she hadn't had a permanent assignment. And they sent one of the black children to in-school suspension, IS test. And so since she wasn't committed, instead of the child being in there and just playing by herself, she said, well, I'll just teach her. And the principal, her new supervisor, walked by, saw her teaching the child, and wrote her up. He said, we don't teach these children when they come into in-school suspension. We just let them play. So, you know, a week into it, this poor black teacher, you know, doesn't know that the children are put in-school suspension so that they will not learn. It has nothing to do with behavior. It is just a tool for interrupting learning. Also, the school board has a new idea. They say, oh, you know, drunk driving is really an issue. Now, this is a school that is 86% non-white. You know, they want to do drunk driving, they should go find the sheriff's daughter who has all of those drug charges and driving under influence. Or they should find, you know, the county judge's son who was arrested on drug charges also. But these are black kids and Hispanic kids, and their new idea is to scare them straight from drunk driving at the end of the semester. They're going to grab one of the students, and they're going to take them out, and they're going to go back and spread the rumor that this student is dead, was involved in drunk driving, celebrating graduation. Now your friend is dead. They're just going to inflict this trauma on these black children because they think that's a good idea. And I'm sure they're doing it just for the hell of it because we are not the subset of the population that has problems with drunk driving. Not that much, anyway. Okay, so I think that's all that's going on in my little area of the planet. And the Sandra Bland issue is not over yet.
That incident with the teacher is kind of workplace racism. Definitely would have fit in that section as well. But good to get it in. Good to get it in. Other folks who chimed in, who have a hand up, if you have any thoughts, observations, feel free. Maybe they're not in a area where they can speak, but the other folks that have a hand, or they're waiting for workplace racism, the other folks that have a hand up, feel free to chime in when you're able. In the meantime, while they're getting themselves together. The piece on Flint, Michigan, I thought that was super important as well. I think we have listeners that are in the Michigan area and have been sending information, and that's been going on for at least a few weeks or so. At least when I think of that, I flashback to, I think it was 2013, with the situation in Detroit where they were turning off people's water and saying that they hadn't paid their bill or whatever the case may be. Just seems they are really going to town on, I mean, it does not get any more basic than water. You can go without food for much, much longer than you can go without water and to have contaminated water, and then they lied about it and said that there was nothing wrong with it, even when people were seeing symptoms that there was a problem that could have been connected to the water situation. I would be curious as to if they just sacrificed a lot of the white people that are in that area, because a lot of the reports that I have seen, they're talking to white people. Like you would, I think Thomas in New York said that Flint is a predominantly black city. Most of the reports that I've seen, they have not shown black citizens of Michigan. They've shown white people and white children that are laboring with this, and oh, this is, you know, terrible, and the health ramifications for their little white children. I have not really seen, at least in the reports I've seen so far, I have not seen a focus on black people and what they think about this, how they're dealing with this. I have not seen that at all, but that's definitely super important and might even be another example of the impotence of the UN, because I think we talked about that before, where they went to the UN when they were having the water turnoffs in Detroit, and I didn't see where they were able to do anything impactful, effective there. I haven't seen that with regards to them dealing with racism at all, but definitely think that's important if other folks have been watching that, keeping an eye on the Flint situation. Other folks who have a hand up should be with us.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'll just speak on I believe it was a City of Chicago Fire Department. Like to say, I was quite shocked by the racism. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not shocked by the racism. The fire service is commonly in this part of the world full of racist practices, as well documented by former Director of Dade County Fire Department, Charles Phillips, Fire Chief Charles Phillips, who did not stay in that capacity, I believe less than a year, primarily based on the fact that he was not willing to fire three black males who, within about within about an hour, their lives were threatened because of comments that they made on September the 12th of 01, right after the so-called buildings collapsing in New York. And Chicago participated in it. They have they, meaning white males primarily, white females along with it also, but white males, interconnected from fire department to fire department in this part of the world. They are very close in that light. I would say it's probably more of a close connection with the fire service than it is with the police department, with white people, and as far as employees knowing each other from state to state, from city to city. The connection is probably more deeper with white males and females who are in the fire service, more so than anything. And I would say probably one of the reasons why is because of the nature of the job. You actually spend 24 hours with each other, whereas most jobs, you know, they start you know, at 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, and in at the end of the day, you know, 5 o'clock, somebody at fire service, you sleep with people on a 24-hour basis, eat. The television, all fire stations have the same amenities that you have in your house. So it's a different atmosphere, so to speak, is what I'm saying. And yes, it is quite white-cultured and dominated. Only a few exceptions, myself and a few guys, we had that more different for a short while. But as I would say, you know, it's the city, I mean, it's much more different than I guess I think it's still the show about the Chicago Fire Department that comes on primetime. I haven't watched it. I don't watch stuff like that because it's so unrealistic in many ways. But I believe it still is a program on television about the fire service, Chicago Fire, I think it's called. Yes, I'm not surprised about the racist practices in hiring, promotion. One of the things that would take place is, let's say if you pass the promotion exam and you're higher up on the list, if they don't want you to be promoted, they would have you lingering on the list until it expires and you have to take the test again. You know, that's a common practice maneuver. So that's something to be understood, that you're going to have that, one of the oldest professions in this part of the world. Thank you for listening.
For sure. I think I might even have a lead-in for workplace racism from Delaware, because I've played a few clips of the past year or so where they've been looking at workplace racism for state employees, black state employees, having all these problems, same thing, but that'll be later in the broadcast. Any other folks that have comments, observations, they want to make sure they get in? If you have a hand up, should be with us. Feel free to chime in. The segment where President Obama was speaking with Anderson Cooper, the town hall meeting, where I guess they were going to discuss what they call gun control. When President Obama was, I guess, challenged about referencing this notion that I've even heard non-white people, some victims endorse, that, you know, this is a plot by the quote-unquote federal government to confiscate and take guns away from us. Where he called it a conspiracy, and the albino suspected racist Anderson Cooper, where he said, "Well, wait a minute now. What do you think it's legitimate to just call this a conspiracy theory?" To me, I process that as, if you're calling this a conspiracy theory, you are delegitimizing their concerns that, you know, this is a legitimate fear that white people like Alex Jones, suspected racist, and many others. Have been saying, you know, that they're going to take our guns. Wait a minute now, President Negro. Do you think that you could just use that sort of term to make it seem like these are not valid concerns, that this is some crackpot idea that people are propagating? And I thought he responded, black self-respect. Yes, it's total nonsense. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I would hope that you would take the same position. I thought that was a moment of black self-respect in his response. But folks had any thoughts on that as well, feel free to share, or anything else that you want to make sure that you get in.
Well, I have few regrets in life, but one of them is that I used to sell guns out of the trunk of my car, and I wish I had the ball back. So it really doesn't matter whether he says he's going to confiscate guns or not. Most of the black people here, we have no intention of getting rid of any guns, and we just don't see any reason to do that.
If they ever make such a move, me being in the Pacific Northwest, I would just get to a spot where I feel like I could watch safely, because I'm pretty sure it would be fireworks in this part of the world where you have lots of armed white people. I would just sit back and, if I could safely, sit back and watch the show, because I'm very, very sure that you have a lot of white people that would not be a willing handover. At a Turner Diary, we did the whole book, Turner Diaries, William Pierce, way back, I think 2012, with the book club.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Oh, hey, hey. Good evening. hey, we see an example of this right now. And I'm curious, was the white terrorist situation in Oregon mentioned in the CNN gun control program?
I didn't see the entire thing. I'd be curious about that myself. I suspect that that whole thing is online. If anybody saw it, do you know if they brought up with the situation in Oregon? I do know that the other reports that I heard pertaining to gun control, nobody cross-referenced to Oregon, at least not the ones that I saw and read about.
Yes, and regarding the shooting of Quan McDonald by the mighty white police officer, it's interesting that same DA, Anita Alvarez, she could be white, she could be non-white, all because of her last name, took her 13 months to her and her office 13 months to indict this cop who shot Laquan McDonald. It only took 8 months for her office to indict Officer Craig Taylor for shooting John Lena. Just thought I would have everybody remember that. That and also the segment with Mark Kelly, Gabrielle Giffords' husband. It is really interesting, and we've discussed this so many times. 5 years later, he still refuses to call the guy who shot his wife a terrorist, even though his actions were clearly political and based on him targeting her, because Jared Loughnan's wife, he still refuses to call him a terrorist, and most people don't. And that segment with Amy Goodman, did you notice the act of racism by the STLC guy, Richard Cohen, how he is just totally dismissive of the black lady who pointed out not only that these people aren't being called terrorists, but how different groups would be treated if they were. And he just immediately went to, oh, I don't think this is a case of, this isn't really an issue of how disparate groups are referenced. Which again, just really goes to show you this whole thing on how we really don't, well, not us, but how white people really don't want to call the political and religious violence or just outright wholesale violence them and their brethren do terrorism. You know, I mean, it's just really fascinating. It reminded me of the Daily News article. Daily News had the front page after the San Bernardino killings. And they described, I believe his name is Saeed Farouk, immediately, this was a terrorist. And then this was the front page. This was a terrorist. And below were Robert Louis Beer, Adam Lanza, James Holmes, Dylan Storm Roof, and Waylon Pierre. So they called Saeed Farouk a terrorist. And then they said, so is James Holmes. So is Adam Lanza. So is Dylan Scott Roof. So is... And so forth. And I just thought, this is just incredibly dishonest. Because when these white men committed these acts of violence, they were not referred to as terrorists. And I'm sure James from New York will agree with me that the Daily News editorial pages did not refer to these white dudes as terrorists. But now you want to make a point, you want to make a fraudulent point and attack and calling a non-white Muslim terrorist, which all people who work in the media do. You want to act like Robert Louis Deal was a terrorist. When his incident happened the week before, and he wasn't called a terrorist, it was about pro-life rhetoric. And we know Adam Lanza, James Holmes were not called terrorists when they did their actions 3 years ago. Mental illness was the issue. Dylan Storm Roof, racism. Confederate flag, not terrorism. Wayne LaPierre, while I don't have a problem with him being called a terrorist, that's just political silliness. And that's all I have to say. Thanks.
For sure. Just make sure I'm trying to be accurate. Charles Blow did briefly mention the Oregon situation with all the talk this week about gun control, but it was very brief. It was not, you know, any meditation on connecting these two events, but he did kind of briefly insert that within his larger piece, which was all about white supremacy and gun control. It was a great segment. Charles Blow, it was editorial for the New York Times, where he used the term white terror over and over again. I think that might have even been in the title of the report, white terror, which is very rare to see that word put together in mainstream print talking about the history of racism. Other folks who dialed in who had a hand up, if you all had comments you wanted to make sure you got in, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How everybody doing tonight? Gus, sorry I missed your other shows when you I think you were sending out information for Dr. Welsing. I actually got to meet Dr. Welsing once, and what was interesting about it was I went to go see her at a show, and as I was walking across the street, she asked me for directions, and I was like, hey, you look familiar. But you know what? I couldn't figure out who she was until she got up on the stage, and it was like, oh, I just met Dr. Wilson, duh. And that was my story of meeting her, and I'm actually sad that living here in Washington, D.C., I never really got the time to actually go see her at Howard University due to me working so much. But I just kind of wanted to share that with everybody. The other thing, I kind of wanted to give you an update on my son. And the reason why was because he had an episode. My son is suffering from mental disorder. I think we talked about that the last time I was on the show. And he actually had an episode where the police was called and he actually had a bat in his hand. I'm sorry, not a bat. He had a knife in his hand. And luckily, when the police arrived, the police did not lock him up. They did not try to subdue him. His mother was there. She called the police. And they was able to get the knife out of his hand and take him to a psychiatric ward and not take him to a hospital. I mean, not take him to jail and not give him a criminal record and everything like that. So that was one incident where the situation actually worked out, you know, without my son getting harmed. There was a white officer there, and there was a black woman. There was a black officer as well. So that is the information. From there, they took him to a psychiatric ward. He stayed for about a week. They diagnosed him with various diseases. I think one of them was schizophrenia. And so as of now, once he moved, came out of the hospital, I actually finally got him to move back home. So he's back with me, and we're kind of just working through his situation. So if anybody wanted to ask me any other questions on that, that's kind of the rest of the follow-up. But he's back at work.
he's taking his medication, and for now he's doing okay. So we just, I'm glad that that situation didn't go wrong real fast, and, you know, we're just working through it. Wow. And I meet my love.
Right on. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. I hope your son makes speedy, rapid recovery. I'm glad the situation where the enforcement officials had to be called, I'm glad that you know, worked out where there was no loss of life. It seemed like he was handled correctly. Someone had just posted a video where they were. Did you say that your child's mother was the one that requested police presence, or was it somebody else?
Yes, she called the police. So he was living in a house with roommates.
Oh, are you still there?
Just went off, or some kind of situation happened. Mm-hmm. So then he kind of went on a rampage, and then his mother was there. He kind of just was it kind of got really unruly real fast, and then she called the police.
Okay. Yeah, it's, I know some, it was a black female. She had just posted a video about not calling enforcement officials on your children. I think this was right after the situation in Chicago, just I think maybe within the last 10 days, where it was a young black male and an older black female mother. They were shot and killed, where I guess the enforcement officials were called by a family member saying that this black male was kind of acting strangely, and, you know, it ended up resulting in two fatalities. But they were just saying to try to avoid calling them. I totally see the logic in it, but it's I know I've heard Mr. Fuller discuss this and others as well, where you can end up just being in a really tough spot where you might need assistance in, you know, helping deal with someone, particularly if they're having any sort of behavioral problems, mental difficulties. I mean, you might need some assistance in just, you know, kind of helping to get the person to calm down so they're not hurting themselves or anybody else. That is a function that peace officers are supposed to serve, but under the system of white supremacy, they end up, you know, just invariably not functioning that way with us. So it can really put you in a bind in terms of how to manage those type of situations. One of those where that's something certain, particularly, I would say, if you are in an area where there are other black people and you know some of these people, that was one of the things that the Black Panther Party was doing in the 1960s that also got them listed as, you know, public enemy number one. But that is one of the things that they were doing. We talked about this before on the program with some of the different authors that we've had and people that have done research on the activities of the Black Panther Party. But they would be the people that you could call in those type of incidents instead of enforcement officers. You could call them if it was a domestic dispute or someone was just not behaving correctly, where they could kind of come in, help stabilize the situation, and you don't have to worry about armed white goons coming and, you know, shooting down the whole neighborhood. But that's definitely something that, you know, we might want to look at trying to see if we could revive or work out as an alternative when you need assistance in dealing with a situation, non-lethal assistance in dealing with a situation.
Yeah, Gus, I agree with you 100%. And I guess to go in further, he had already been having problems with the roommates. He said he had been hearing voices. And then when his roommate, they got into the altercation as far as a verbal altercation, then he just grabbed a knife. And then sometimes, you know, like you can have family members come in, and his mother, it didn't go well when she tried to calm him down, so he then put his hands on everybody in the house, and then he grabbed a knife. And then at that point, when I was talking to him, he was just ready to just let go. And again, like I said, luckily when the police, and so she called the police, and then the police asked her, well, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to take him to jail, or do you want us to take him to the psychiatric ward? And luckily she agreed to just have him go to a psychiatric ward. And then it was resolved that way. Then they kept him in the ward for at least 7 days. And then they released him on his own recognizance, but he has to go back periodically to see a psychiatrist and everything like that. But for the most part, he's okay for now.
Wow. Dr. Frances Cress-Wells, and she would definitely say black people do not qualify for mental health under this system with all the trauma and stress that they put on us. It really can have a huge impact on our thoughts, speech, action, emotions, and just really compromising our health. That's, man, since you're right in D.C. too, it, you know, the loss again, she would have, maybe if you could have been able to speak with her and, you know, kind of get her opinion on what's happening, that is an enormous loss. Once again, Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing.
Yeah, guys, I think the other thing was that I did not know, and I guess this is something for all of us when we go into dating, I did not know that my son's mother suffered from psychological issues as well. And not saying that's a reason not to date her, but I think it's something, like you said, to look out for when you're going into dating people, you know, what kind of mental health people are under. So because she suffered through mental health, my son has also suffered through mental health. And now if he ever decides to have kids, even though he's homosexual, I have to now pay attention to that and be mindful of that.
For me, that just reminds me of the 200 questions that is suggested in terms of, you know, asking a lot of questions before you get to the bedroom and really planning that out. That's another one, just about not playing around with sex and really taking that seriously, the act of creating a human life. I just want to know, you know, as much detail as possible about this person and the plan for creating another life, to take that very, very seriously. Ask a lot of questions. Ask a lot of questions.
Copy, Hurt?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I had wanted to make a comment about something that you said earlier, Gus, about Obama displaying levels of black self-respect. And I just want to say that I don't think Obama has an ounce of black self-respect in him. Not even a gram. And, you know, that's kind of like a statement. I don't get it. You know, these problems that the country faces, no, they're not his. But he's the administrative director of white supremacy right now. He knew what he was getting himself into. And I don't have any respect for him. I mean, other than the fact that he's the president, I was happy to see a black man make the president. That no one can ever take that away from me, the joy I felt that day. But I would have respect for him if he stood up against these police terrorists. But he doesn't mention them. You know, he sent Holder to St. Louis. This big federal investigation came past, and then Loretta Lynch went back on most of that stuff. It's just I don't have any respect for the dude, and I don't think that he displays any levels of black self-respect. People who display high levels of black self-respect, like Dr. Welsing, I mean, if you compare those two people, they're complete opposites. And also, all the problems in Chicago. Let's not forget, Rahm Emanuel is Obama's boy. That was his chief of staff, I believe. I mean, he was positioned in that place. The guns in Chicago. I recall an investigation called Fast and Furious that Obama sealed, where him and Eric Holder were responsible for a lot of those guns in Chicago coming from Mexico. And I don't think that saying he has any level of black self-respect is accurate at all. And that's all I have to say.
All right, on. I certainly wouldn't compare any victim of racism to another in terms of black self-respect, and I didn't say that he had high levels of black self-respect. I talked about that one statement, that one moment, the exchange with Anderson Cooper, and for everything else that you stated about the Fast and Furious and Eric Holder, what happened in Ferguson. As I said earlier, the people who are most to blame for all of that, racist man, racist woman, racist child. And just generally, this is beyond President Obama. I do not make presumptions about what another non-white person knows when they have that information. I never do that because I'm not in that person's head, and I don't know what they know about racism, white supremacy. That's just something that is a part of my personal code in terms of not making assumptions about knowledge that other victims of racism have or don't have. At the end of the day, he's a non-white person. He is not the person that is most blamed for what's happening in Chicago or anywhere else under the system of white supremacy. Anybody else have anything else they wanted to make sure we get in? Didn't miss anybody who had a hand up. Other folks who just dialed in, did you have anything you wanted to make sure you got in?
Good evening, everyone. I just want to say, speaking for myself, I'm trying to make a concerted effort to, and I know, Gus, you say this all the time. Neely Fuller says it all the time. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing said it all the time. And I noticed that a lot of, you know, black people or non-white people in the media don't do this, even though they're aware of racism, white supremacy, the name calling. That's a big thing. I know a lot of people that have a lot of influence, particularly in the black, I guess with black people or in the black community, so to speak. They continue to name call, you know, especially other black people. I'm trying to make a concerted effort with myself for not doing it. You know, that should be one of one that's going to be, I guess, one of my New Year's resolutions or whatever. But something that I'm trying to do is stop name calling black people or non-white people or anybody for that matter. And you know, and then also just like, I guess, in the media with LeBron James, how they're criticizing him about not taking a stand for Tamir Rice. You know, I've just been noticing that on the internet a lot. And it's like, all right, what about the white police officer that murdered that child? Like, how we allow the narrative to change from folks focusing on, you know, these white racists, turn it back on black people, man. We really, 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 really have to make a concerted effort to not do that, especially myself, too, because I find myself doing that.
Yeah. Your line is breaking up a little bit. You said you have to make a concerted effort, even with yourself, to not do that, and then it kind of broke up a little bit. Oh, are you still there? Are you still there? Oh, looks like he got disconnected. He'll perhaps dial back in. I had seen that as well. I had posted about that. There was a black female in Cleveland that died in police custody this week, and I think I posted it. Are they going to blame this on LeBron James as well? It's common, extremely common, where it ends up becoming, it's President Obama's fault, it's Jesse Jackson's fault, it's Al Sharpton's fault, it's LeBron James' fault, where white people mistreat us, and then somehow it gets directed to another victim where it's their fault because they didn't do this or they didn't speak up or whatever the case may be. And the problem is white people. They are astounding with all of that. And LeBron James seems to be one of their more popular ones of late. I feel like I've heard that pop up for years now when something happened. And why didn't he say something? And no good coon and Uncle Tom. Like, I've heard that for years and years and years. And it's the same thing. It solves no problems. We can all sit around and talk bad about LeBron James for the next 8 years or whenever until he retires or until we get tired of talking bad about him. That's not going to solve any problems. The problem is still white people. We're still going to have to deal with racist man, racist woman, racist child. Yes, it would be nice if everybody that's non-white was stepping up and doing as much as they could to work against racism. That's not the case. If he's not going to do it, what are we, what am I, what are you going to do in the meantime to solve this problem? That's, I think, how you get things done. I could be in error.
Can I be heard?
I just wanted to. Yes, sir, I can hear you. I just wanted to double check the female.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
No worries. The person that just got disconnected. Did you want to finish your statement about just one of the things that you're working on this year in terms of not name calling other black people? Did you want to finish your comment?
It's like 11:30, 11:45.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Just make sure you speak up.
Yes, I was just saying that, you know, the narrative with a lot of these stories are always being changed from, like I was saying with Tamir Rice, and then now they're talking about LeBron James, how he's not supporting, you know, the Tamir Rice murder. And they're talking about, oh, this guy's making all this money in Cleveland, and why is he not wearing a T-shirt, you know? And I guess, you know, before he was wearing a T-shirt for Hands Up, Don't Shoot. But it's like, how did that story turn from, you know, this white racist murdering this young, this black child to LeBron James not doing what we think he's supposed to do or whatever? But it's just like, I just find myself, even myself, again, just trying not to, you know, we should not be using not one bit of energy, no type of energy. That's what I just think, no energy criticizing non-white people, particularly black people. And we have to put all this focus, all the focus on these racist white supremacists. That's all I have for now. I'll probably, you know, share something for workplace racism. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Lady, did you have something that you wanted to share? You should be with us.
Hello, everyone. Actually, I did. Thank you. Listening to some of the lady who was speaking about the medical issues and things that were happening with racism as regards to healthcare. It was just very interesting, all these extra terms and extra words that were just made up just instead of outright saying and acknowledging that there is built-in racism within healthcare. This is a challenge for me, as for a lot of other victims who are either on the side of giving or being provider of health services. And when it comes to receiving services, I want to ask some of the listeners, I'm in New York, I'm trying to transition from the people that I'm receiving health care and my family to a black physician, but I am having a terrible time finding physicians that are black. Usually when I'm looking online, I have to jump through hoops. Their pictures are not up there because I'm pretty sure a lot of non-black persons will see a black person's picture and then scroll down and not want to contact their practice. But if anyone has advice about getting services or how to locate a black physician, please let me know, because this is something I've been struggling with for almost 2 years, and it just becomes very difficult to where I just don't even look, because it's just like just such searching. It's never ending. So if anyone can let me know, I'd appreciate that.
Good question. Hopefully someone can assist with that. I know we have listeners in the New York area, and that has kind of come up before, trying to find healthcare for black healthcare providers and the difficulty with that. Even if you listen to the archives and you have some input on that, you can drop me an email at intiljustice@gmail.com, and that way I can pass it along. But that is definitely needed, important information. Firefighter, were you going to share as well?
Yes, sir. I'm just going to include that the whole idea about non-white black people criticizing other non-white black people of what they are saying or doing against the system of racism or white supremacy is one of the main things that has me kind of like angry, I would say. I guess that's the best word I can think right now, because most cases when that takes place, the one who is making these type of statements is not doing nothing close to what they are criticizing the other non-white black person that they are not doing. I hope I'm being clear on how I'm expressing it. In most cases, from my observations, they're not walking in their job with a T-shirt on, stating about somebody's black dead child that was murdered by the police. They're not walking on their job with a T-shirt on, that sort of thing. But they want somebody else to do it, and I can give all other kind of examples of that. And it's one of those situations where some of us just can't speak or act on the system of racism or supremacy without criticizing another non-white black person, and. It's just something that I make an observation of, and from it helps me to not to fall into that negativity. They're very interesting. I was thinking about the LeBron James situation. I can somewhat see it if it's a situation whereas there is someone who is in the same profession or maybe on the same team, in his case or something like that, that is saying that, I'm taking these risks and I sure would like to see some of my teammates or some of the other employees on the job, you know, do the same thing if that person acts, you know, but criticizing like that and you're not doing anything at all to put things at risk for yourself, you know, it just leaves something to be desired. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Right on. Reminded of... Chris Everett, he was on the program just a few weeks back. He did that documentary film on the white terrorism in Wilmington, North Carolina, right at the close of the 19th century. He said that it was an NBA basketball player who helped him get the final funds he needed to finish the project and complete the film. But the money was given on the condition of anonymity, that they didn't want, you know, to be recognized for having done anything. And I thought that was highly significant, because even a black person who has a lot of money and a stable profession and what have you, apparently feels some trepidation about being associated with counter racist activity. And to me, that suggested that they know white people could put a hurting on you real quick, and take away the few nickels that they have given you and have you, you know, looking for another job within days, hours, if that's the decision that they choose to take. And whites have done this before. So I think that's something to keep in mind as well, in terms of before we get excited about criticizing other victims of racism. I think I've said before, when you are in the mood to hold folks accountable, pull out your mirror. That should keep you busy. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in? We have about 3 minutes before we get to workplace racism.
I would like to mention something really quickly. I know I said I was done to workplace racism, but I'm not trying to advertise for this suspected racist, but the deceased comedian George Carlin used to do a little bit that I thought was interesting about, you know, words, about how I guess like in World War II, how they defined the term as like shell shocked, when, you know, these soldiers and, you know, these American Armed Forces members were having like PTSD. But he just kind of put out the progression of how they diluted those words, and always kind of related that back to this program, and how we have to be really important with with the way that we use words. He kind of went through the progression of how people, how I guess particularly the, you know, American society has diluted words to just to be manipulative and just to be deceptive pretty much. And I think people should try to check that a little bit out on YouTube or something if they get a chance. So I thought it was interesting. Thank you.
Right on. I'm going to see if this audio clip will work so that I can include. These are just black employees, citizens in Delaware, talking about white supremacy that they encounter on the job as state employees that they're encountering on the job. I think this has been like a long running investigation because I've seen quite a few reports about this over the past 12 months at least. But I thought it would be an interesting segue to workplace racism. The number again is 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943-pound. But this is different black employees talking about their experience of racism working in the state of Delaware, and same things we've heard before. I suspect even some of the callers on this line have unfortunately had to endure. Hope the audio is straight because I had kind of forgotten about this, so I didn't get a chance to edit it up and everything, but I'll see if it's straight from here. If not, I can stop it and we can proceed, but I'll see if I thought it was powerful when I heard it. I'll see if it works out for us. And it's being stubborn. It might not play. We'll try one more time and see if we get it to work for us. If not, then we'll just roll on and see if folks that are on the line have things they would like to share. In fact, I might even just include it in the podcast once we're done, because I did think it was important what they, just their observations, their experience, what they have been enduring, these black citizens in Delaware. I'm going to try one more time and see if it works out for us. Let's see. And again, these switchboard problems, as I said, this has been like the last 3 weeks or so. It's been really strange, the different errors and complications with the switchboard. Let's see, last attempt, see if it'll work out. And it's looking like it's still not going to work. Nope, not going to play. Oh, well, we tried. I'll see if we can include it in the podcast, and I'll post the report where they detail some of their experiences in the state of Delaware. But if folks that are with us, if you have commentary you want to share on workplace racism, feel free. Line should be open for all the folks who dialed in with a hand up.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to all the callers. I definitely wanted to chime in on workplace racism. The last time I think I chimed in, I was explaining my termination with the law firm here in Michigan. And since then, I have found another law firm where I'm employed. And I had the unfortunate opportunity to get hired in right during, you know, the Christmas festivities. And I went to the Christmas party. It just so happened that it was like that Friday of the same week that I got started. And I'm like new. So I really, you know, was just trying to observe everyone. And, you know, the Christmas party was at a restaurant. So everybody, you know, they had their drinks and they were really relaxed. And so they did this thing where it was like a gift exchange called the White Elephant. And I was totally, you know, ignorant to what it was. And so it was a gift exchange. And there's two black girls that work there, and along with me, the rest of the employees are all white or either classified as like Chaldean. And so they do this gift exchange. And there's this one white attorney. He's kind of obnoxious, and you know, he's the funny guy, I guess. And so he kind of gave one of the black girls like a a tip or as to which gift to choose from the table. So you pick a number, you go to the table, and you choose a gift that's wrapped. And she, it was her turn to go up to the table, and she picked the gift, and you're supposed to open the gift in front of everyone so you can see what it is, and I guess you swap gifts if you don't like it, something like that. So she goes up to the table, picks the gift. It's supposed to be, you know, like random, but, you know, he gave her this kind of hint, I guess, to pick his gift. And so she unwrapped it, and it was a black penis. It was the most, I mean, because all the other gifts were candles and calendars and just, you know, under $20 gifts. But he goes to some kinky store and gets a black penis. And so everyone was just, you know, just abrupted in laughter. And I was just like, wow, this is really interesting that he made sure she got his gift. And that was just, you know, like the joke for the day. And I thought that was interesting. The other thing I noticed that this law firm, it's a smaller law firm than where I was previously. And I started at the end of December, and then they brought on another white paralegal. And she started like a week after me. So when I started, I didn't get any assistance as far as, you know, helping me understand their software and just, you know, they just kind of put me in a place, explained to me that they had to fire the lady that I was replacing. And so everything is kind of a mess, and be patient with us. And in other words, you just got to figure it out. And no help, no assistance. I noticed that, you know, the black girls that worked there, they weren't helpful. They were friendly, but they're very just not helpful, which I'm not I'm used to that. So that was, you know, expected. But I didn't get any assistance. So I'm just, you know, stumbling along, just trying to just figure things out. I've been doing that, and that's fine. And then I noticed the white paralegal that started a week after me, right, you know, I think she started the week of the new year. And I just noticed how helpful everyone is to her. Some of the same, I mean, it's amazing. It kind of cracks me up, because it's even just like with faxing something, using the copy machine, how to do like simple office procedures, she's asking for help, and they're just so helpful. They're, you know, just making sure that she's not just sitting there without any assistance. And it's like night and day. So I thought that was interesting. I'm very just thankful that I'm less confused now. It's been a while since I've been in an environment with working with people like this, because prior to me being at that previous law firm, I was, you know, I had the opportunity for over the last 4 to 5 years to kind of do work virtually from home, or, you know, I would go into an office every now and then, but I had minimal contact with white people and non-white people. So when my situation changed, where I had to actually go and, you know, just, you know, sit in the office all day just around people, and it's just amazing. It's like I'm really just studying them, and just everything that I'm learning has been verified over and over again. So I just wanted to share that it's just interesting, because I find myself just observing the behaviors and being able, you know, I took for granted the fact that I was away from people for so long, but now just studying them and seeing how black people act in a work environment and white people, it's been extremely interesting. So those were just the things I want to share about my experience over the last few weeks.
Profound. Number one, I would submit that as an act of racism on the part of the white males, part for nudging this black female to get his gift, which was, and he didn't even give a white penis. He gave a black penis. I'd say that is a huge Welsing moment. I was listening to audio clips today where, just huge Welsing moment, constant focus on black genitalia. And then the help situation that I feel like we've heard that play out repeatedly on this program. I mean, that is the system of white supremacy at work, where you come in brand new, trying to be helpful, and nobody, we don't have 5 minutes to show you where the coffee maker is. And then this white person comes along, and everyone is stumbling, falling, anything you need. Do you need help opening that soda? Mm-hmm. Here's 50 cents. Let me buy you a whole can. I mean, it's the system of white supremacy at work. And I think, at least for me, I think when you start to understand what that is and why that's happening, I think it can help you deal with it better, as opposed to being, you know, really angry and taking it out on other people and that sort of thing. Why are they being all nice to her and, you know, treating me like I'm nobody and that sort of thing? When you're like, oh, okay, this is what I would expect in a system of white supremacy in terms of, you know, why she's getting all this help and why you're not. But profound, profound.
I just also wanted to say also, again, I'm in a situation where I'm working at a law firm where we are dealing with clients who have been in auto accidents. So one thing I appreciate about the position that I'm in, because like you said, you know, I don't take it as, you know, I'm just learning that this is the system at work. So I'm not offended by it in the sense where, you know, oh, you know, why are you guys treating me, you know, her better? Because that's what it is, as you said. But being in a situation that I get to have direct contact with the black clients that call in, once again, I'm just so thankful that I can help them as best I can. I hear the relief every time I answer my phone and they can tell it's a black person that's, you know, on the other end and calling them back and just really being responsive to their needs. So I just take it as an opportunity to really just help people where I can, because once again, it's another firm where black people are being so mistreated, and I just have an opportunity to help. So that's what I really appreciate. So that's the one thing I focus on when I'm in the office. I can, you know, say, you know, let me make sure I make this client's case a priority and really follow through and make sure things get done. So
black self-respect, right on. A+, do the little bit that you can in the position that you're in. That's black self-respect, doing what you can. Although I did think you said the last time when you did that on the job, you felt like that could have even been why they chose to get rid of you, because you were trying to be helpful.
Yeah. And the culture at that other firm, it wasn't, you know, it's like we don't help them. We just take their money. So we'll see how this plays out. I mean, we'll see.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Other folks, if you have, you know, comments on that or your own things that you want to share, feel free. Workplace racism, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
So I had a suspected racist white female completely intrude upon my time, my space, and other things, of course, and just practice white supremacy. So she came to my office like the damsel in distress with, I had a problem down in my department. And granted, this suspected racist is, well, you know, their position is well over mine, not in my direct department, but within the building that we work in. Way more educated, just, you know, whatever, and white on top of that. So she comes and says, oh, I have a problem in my department. Okay, so she tells me this long, drawn-out story about two non-white people, one black person, one non-white, non-black person, how they did something wrong within the department. And I'm their direct supervisor. She's their supervisor as well, but in a different way. But So she gives me this long, drawn-out story. It takes maybe about half an hour, about maybe an hour. The total amount of time was probably about an hour and a half. So she says, oh, my computer isn't working, and these people did this, or they didn't do this, which caused me to do something wrong as well. So I have to put a report on this, you know, wrong thing that I did on the computer. So, and she, you know, she needs me to help her. Her computer isn't working, allegedly or supposedly, and she needs to use, can I use your computer? So, you know, I say yes, of course, you know. So she uses my computer, which I was doing other work on. So she needs help navigating through this program to put this report in about what happened in her department, which caused her to, you know, caused her to do this wrongdoing. So she's, oh, what do I press here? How do I say this? And what words should I put this? And I'm like, I'm just thinking, lady, you're what, much more educated and whatever than me. Why are you asking me? And you know what? You know, but, you know, I go ahead and help her because, again, she could, you know, have an effect on my progress at the job. So, and then she says, okay, these two non-white people down there, on top of them not doing something right, they were making inappropriate comments that someone else overheard, and they told me about it, or told her about it, you know, the white lady about it. So, she tells me about this, and she says, oh, I really care about them, and I don't want to get them in trouble. What do you think I should do? What do you think I should do? I'm like, I don't know. Well, what do you think? You think you could talk to them and see, you know, see what happened? I really don't want them to get in trouble, but can you talk to them? And I said, okay, I'm their direct supervisor. Okay, I can talk to them. Then she wants to dictate to me how to talk to them, and she wants to manipulate the situation to where she's not implicated in the person that wants to do the investigation and maybe accuse the two non-white people of doing something wrong. She wants me to say it to where, okay, just say you overheard something. Not that I told you or I wanted you to talk to them. Just say it like this. And I'm like, okay, wow. Just another example of a manipulative, you know, racist, really just in the background because she doesn't want to be the so-called bad person to directly talk to them about what they did wrong or allegedly did wrong. But she wants me to do it and me to carry it out and me, you know, so, you know, these two non-white people can look at me like, oh, you know, why are you coming down on us? And why are you even talking to us about this? And then, so later on, what she accused them or she thought someone heard them saying inappropriate in their department, it didn't even happen that way. So, of course, you know, I don't believe in apologies. I don't want an apology. It's definitely saying you're sorry means nothing to me. But, you know, she didn't come up and try to, you know, even say, hey, you know, I'm sorry I wasted your time. It didn't even happen that way. I haven't heard from her. I haven't seen her since. And she's been at work and I've been at work. And she knows where I, you know, my office and all that. So I just thought that was really, really, I thought it was racist.
White women, the treachery. If I don't know, you might want to hunker down. If you get any accusations of being a sellout for that, going in and reprimanding these non-white people or interrogating them for their alleged misconduct. But just in my view, that's what I mean about it's super important to just kind of keep that in the forefront of our mind. The people that are most to blame are white. In this situation where you got a false accusation, that's every day with regards to non-white people, particularly black people, some sort of accusation, some sort of charge that we did this, you did this, you said that, you stole this, you looked at this person. That's every day. Now we got to waste all this time to go and on some rumor or some lie that somebody made up to get this, and she doesn't even want to do it. I don't want to look like the bad person. I'd rather have them upset with you, not me, even though I'm the one who's in charge here. I have more power. I'd rather have them be upset with you and thinking that you were the one that was rooting around and trying to get some problem, get them in trouble or what have you, get them written up on the job for something that they said. It turns out to not even be true. That's just a standard operating procedure. Whites do this all the time on the job. All areas of people activity, they do this sort of thing. I think it's very important for us to keep that in mind at all times. And just with the power dynamic, exactly what you said, she can end up having an impact on whether you get your paycheck on time, whether you continue to be employed there. So it's not like you have power to be able to say, hey, I'm not doing this. You go do your own dirty work. I don't, you know, get out of my office. In fact, I'm done. It's not like you're in position to do that sort of thing. That is the system of white supremacy. Again, I think it's very important to keep those power dynamics in mind. And particularly, as I say consistently, do not sleep on or with white women. They are extraordinarily dangerous, particularly, I would say, in any sort of workplace environment. Extremely dangerous.
And Gus, I really did want to tell her to, you know, kick rocks and, you know, get up out of there, but, you know, of course I couldn't. I did speak with the non-white black person that was accused of doing something, and I made it very clear that, hey, I do not know whether you did this or not, but if this happened to have happened, please don't do it again, and we'll discuss it further depending on where they want to take it. And so I tried to make sure that, hey, you need to direct your whatever frustration or anger not at me, but, you know, that's kind of frowned upon in my field, because they didn't want you to say, hey, if you're given an order or someone told you to do something, you carry it out like it's your order. You don't want to say, well, so-and-so has directed me to do this, because you're not being a true leader by doing that. But thank you.
I people have said that before on the program, because they bring up that same power dynamic. It plays out every day under this system. White people are in charge, and they send us out to, you know, do their bidding, things that are going to strengthen the system of white supremacy, and we end up being the ones that get blamed for it. But even that right there is lying, because if I'm doing something that somebody else told me to do, and they have more power than I do at this job, meaning that they can decide to fire me, I can't decide to fire them, I'm not the leader. I'm lying. I mean, that is what they call corporate strategy that is being endorsed, promoted. Lie to yourself. Say, yes, I'm the leader, and have other people believe that, when that's not true. This is coming from somebody else, and I'm just doing what they told me, the same that you all are. I'm not the one that does the hiring and firing. I'm not even in charge of my own job and making sure that I have stable employment here. I'm following orders. It's very, very important, I think, to keep that in mind. I think that can easily get lost. And in fact, I think their system depends on that getting lost and us taking it out on other folks, as opposed to keeping in mind, again, who is most to blame, who ultimately has power in these situations.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I actually had a question for the last two persons who spoke. For the gentleman, I was wondering if, because it was such a long, drawn-out, and it was, I think that was like an exhaustion technique to get you to just be like, okay, just come on with it and finish. It definitely was a strategy. Was it possible to say, you know, that was a lot of information, can I have this in writing? And I think if she definitely didn't want to technically put it in writing, my alerts would have been up really, really high that this was a game she was playing. But I think you kind of already knew that from the beginning. And for the female caller, with the change in experience from working primarily on your own at home and now working in the office, do you think that you would want to go back to working at home because of the already dynamic of mistreatment, or pretty much kind of some kind of neglect, to help you get acclimated on this new job? And so those are my two questions.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Just in response to that question, I definitely would prefer to work from home. And I'm not opposed to it still, because the contract that I had with an attorney where I was able to work from home, he retired. I found that when I go and am looking for new contracts, and I make that suggestion, I'm just having a harder time at the moment, just securing something that where I can, maintain a stable or stability with my lifestyle and taking care of my family. So I had no other option but to go into the work environment, but I'm still looking for opportunities where I can stay home. Because of technology and what I do, I find that it's not something that's not possible because I've done it before. It's just a matter of finding just contracts where I can really, sustain a comfortable lifestyle. So in the meantime, I had to do what I had to do. But by all means, by every stretch of the imagination, I am looking to come back home. Because I'm less confused, I see the benefit and the value of minimizing contact, definitely with white people, but also with non-white people, because it's different. It's just, I would prefer to just minimize the contact and just deal with people on a constructive basis. And in the workplace, it's just so much foolishness that goes on in that environment that I definitely would prefer to look for opportunities at home and encourage other people. And I remember last time I spoke on workplace racism, Gus, you put that challenge out to try to compile just a list of things that, black people can do to generate money from home. And I'm working on putting something together and just to, present just ways that you can work from home and make money, because I've done it before. I was successful doing it. It just, unfortunately, the person who was able to, sustain income for me doing that, he retired. And so now I'm kind of like at square one, but I'm definitely working very hard to go back to that. So.
Awesome. Awesome. I guess there was another question on the table for the mail caller.
Yes. I absolutely do think that was one of the strategies that she was employing. I also think it was kind of a little sexual type of, hey, I'm the, model, white woman here. You need to do what I want you to do. I'm blessing you with my presence by being in your office. And yeah, she was intruding upon my space, my time, and just trying to wear me down with her racism. And I could have asked her to put it in writing, but again, there would have been repercussions to that. So she would have been, basically, she wouldn't have said this. I don't think she would have just thought, like, who are you to ask me to put anything in writing? I'm giving it to you the way I want to give it to you. And basically, if I would have posed that to her, she would have went, the Voltron effect would have definitely appeared. She would have went, behind and started talking to her colleagues that are, much in a higher position than me. And, yeah, it would have just been some negative repercussions if I had done that. So.
Well, thank you too for responding to those questions, and I can definitely understand what you're saying. How, especially with her, kind of pretty much just being in your space, maybe having that sexual element with her trying to reverse that on you, saying that you went, tried to get assistance, and then it turned into something else. So I 100% understand where you're coming from with how you handled it and why. And so again, thanks to the both of you for answering and clarifying those things.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I'll be quick. I wanted to ask a question. A friend of mine that's in a management position had a secretary that worked for them, and it was an old white woman. And the old white woman was in the position for like over 40 years, so they had only worked with white people. So when they got the black supervisor in, they kind of kept it neutral, but then the white lady eventually let her racism out. And then my black friend, with a one-on-one situation, spit in the lady's face. And then she didn't lose her job. It was a one-on-one situation, so it was kind of my word against yours. But what was interesting is my black friend asked me, do you think I was wrong in the way that you handled it? So I wanted to bring it to everybody else, for everybody else to say, what would you do if you was in that situation where you had a white person under you and they was racist? And how would you react to that situation? Because she said she spit in the lady's face and the lady just got removed to another location, and it kind of went that direction that nobody never knew what happened because it was in a closed environment. But I thought that was a very interesting workplace racist incident.
I definitely wouldn't encourage spitting. I know from the Ron Artest incident that happened in Detroit years ago, where it was a big fight at a basketball game. I know that some places, if you spit on somebody, that's simple assault. Like, that's not, you know, a small deal. Like, that, you know, can be, you could end up in prison for spitting on somebody, you know, depending on where you are and what the laws are. So I definitely wouldn't encourage that. I think that's come, even retired firefighter in Florida mentioned that, where it was a black person, they were supposed to be the chief of the fire department, and they were having problems in terms of, they're supposed to be in charge, they're supposed to be the boss, but we are still in a system of racism. I would say, if it's somebody that you're supposed to be directly supervising, you're supposed to be a direct manager, quote unquote, of this person, if they're saying things, document. I'm a big time advocate of getting it recorded, what that person is saying, what that person is doing. If that's the way that it's being manifest, if they're like doing something to you, trying to sabotage things or whatever else that they're doing, I would just try and be as detailed as possible in making reports, and then, you know, being able to present that information to whomever else that, you know, this person is causing a problem, and what should we do to resolve this situation. You can handle it that way. I think Mr. Fuller definitely would recommend going the Constitution route and saying that this, you know, could be a violation of the 14th Fifth Amendment in terms of due process on the job, if this person, depending on what the person is doing. If it's just saying, I would just want a record of exactly what it is that they're saying. If it's blatant racist speech, if it's insubordination, where they're challenging you, if it's yelling, that, so just depending on what it is, I would, if it's just verbal, I would want a record of what they're doing. Try to get witnesses so you have people that can corroborate what's being said, and just, you know, try and pursue it, just making sure that it's documented and other people know that this is happening, and seeing if you can get more powerful white people to intervene to help you solve that problem.
I would like to say that I supervise a lot of white people, and I think, you know, the overwhelming majority of them, if not all of them, are racist. They typically don't, they are very, very, very codified. They don't do anything that's overtly racist where if I could document it and say, hey, this is what this person is doing, they're being racist. Basically, they do a lot of slick things like just make things difficult, drag out processes, and they could, and they possibly, I get the feeling that they are looking to say that I'm practicing racism on them, like, oh, you know, they don't like the fact that I'm white. I get the feeling that they're trying to get me to get off my game, like, you know, your friend did, and spit in her face. Now she can say, oh, he's being racist against her for being white. So, no, they're very, very codified. And I just try to stick straight to doing my job, and I don't entertain their behavior. I don't tolerate any foolishness or trying to drag things out, and I just try to stick to that. But, yeah, that's my experience with that.
Good point. I think that happens a lot, too, when it's a black person that's, quote-unquote, in charge, where they try to turn it around and say that, in fact, you, the black person, are racist in what you're doing. I think that's very common.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I had a school police racism incident. Is that okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Wednesday evening, my wife got a call from my kid's school, and they wanted to speak to her about something that my son did. So she got to the school, and she met with the dean of discipline, and he explained to her that the teacher reprimanded him, and he mumbled under his breath, "Bitch." So, of course, my wife confronts him, and he said he didn't do it. She said, "I didn't mumble that, you know, that word at all." And the dean was very adamant, "Well, that's what the teacher heard." And so she took him out in the hallway, and she asked him, you know, one-on-one, you know. And usually when he's lying, he has a certain characteristic to him. But in this instance, he did what he does when he's telling the truth. He started crying. And I didn't do it, you know, very adamant. So she at that point said, you know, she didn't believe that he did it. So she said, "I'll." And my son are in the classroom now. And the white teacher, the dean is a Latino male. I think he's Puerto Rican, might be Dominican. And the teacher's white. Now, I met with this teacher a few months earlier about a problem that she had with him. That wasn't that big a deal. But when I met with her, she's a very young white woman with a lot of freckles. And I find those people, white people with those characteristics, to be extremely dangerous. I think because they got a lot of brown on their face or black on their face, that, you know, they have a certain confliction with black people, and that's what the vibe I got from her. And my son's complaints are always, you know, he's not very nice to the teachers. You know, he's, you know, I'm so nice to him, and he just doesn't display the same, you know, love back to me. And, you know, sometimes I just wonder, he just sits there and, you know, he kind of ignores me. And, you know, however, you know, that's been an ongoing thing since he's been in school. He doesn't generally like the teachers. But at the same time, he's taken a state exam for reading. He got two questions wrong, and for math, he got four questions wrong. He's one of the highest performing scholars they have. So either way, when a white teacher gets in the classroom and my wife says, "Now exactly what happened?" She says, "Oh, well, I think I heard him mumble under his breath, 'Bitch.'" She said, "Well, are you 100% sure?" She said, "No, I'm not." And I asked the other students, and they said that they didn't hear it. You know, they didn't hear him say that either. So she says, so she turns to the dean, and why exactly is he being suspended for a day if the teacher's not 100% sure she didn't say that? So he, right in front of the teacher, says, "Well, she told me when she came to the office that that's what she heard, 100%, absolutely." And my wife says, "Well, you know, she just sat here right in front of both of us and said that she thinks that's what she heard, and none of the other students heard it that sat close to them." So the principal comes in. The principal is a white-identified Asian woman. She is very non-Asian, non-traditional Asian. She carries herself like a white woman. She talks very much like a white woman. You can tell, just from my experience, she's one of those very white-identified Asian people. So she calls the teacher out, and she tells my son to leave the classroom while she discussed the situation with the teachers and my wife. And she said, you know, well, my wife tells her, you know, this teacher saying that she didn't hear it 100% of the way, and I don't think he should be suspended. So the principal says, well, give me a few seconds. Let us go outside and discuss this. So her and the teacher go down the hall, and my son overheard the principal yelling at the teacher. So when they came back in the classroom, the teacher says, oh, I'm so sorry that this happened. You know, I misspoke. I definitely heard him say it 100% of the way. And she said, oh, now you heard him say it after you went outside and spoke to the principal. And, you know, they tried to give her the runaround. So she left very angry and, you know, decided to take things to a higher level with, as far as with the head of the school. But, you know, I was explaining to her that you just witnessed, you know, in a form the Voltron effect, you know, how she called out in the hallway. They got their story straight. She comes in, apologizes, and changes her story. And, you know, they kind of walk off, and the dean walks out and said, you know, he was so sorry, you know, that happened. You know, he, you know, she came to me and said it was 100%, and, you know, I can see why you're so angry. But, you know, I only did this based off of what she told me. And that was kind of where it ended, and my wife left, sent a very long note to the head of the school, and we're waiting to hear something back. But he served his one-day suspension and went back to school Friday. And she didn't get in any altercations or anything with the teacher on Friday. But I just felt like that was a huge form of racism, how they called out in the hallway, they switched up, they got their story straight, and the white lady came back and changed the whole story. I mean, my mom.
I'm sorry your son had to endure that. I was reminded immediately the program that we did, I guess maybe 2 months ago. We had a black guest on. He was talking about why black male teachers are leaving the profession. Not that it's very many of them to begin with, but the few that are there are leaving. And he talked about white female teachers and the research that he presented. He said that 70% of teachers in the U.S. right now are white women. And I remember asking him, in my view, is it accurate to say that white women are at the center of what they call the school to prison pipeline? And he said, oh my gosh, that's ridiculous. I'm paraphrasing, but I mean, that is about the size of what he said. You know, that is, Gus, you're talking crazy, and that's nutty to even say, and there's so many different variables and factors that lead to that. It's absurd to posit that white women are at the center of this problem. And I acknowledged on the program, I probably could have worded the question differently, but if they're 70% of the folks that are in front of the classroom, yeah, I do think it's accurate to say that, yes, it's her. She is the one that's at the center of this problem. That would seem to be yet another illustration that maybe that is true. Maybe that is what's happening. And particularly with this, you know, the details of what you presented about this incident, and you know your child, you know the behavioral tendencies he exhibits when he's telling the truth and when he's not. And you believe that he was telling the truth here, that he didn't say anything, and then she's switching her. That, to me, I mean, that's all I would need to know right there, that she came out and said that she kind of didn't hear it, she wasn't sure, it sounded like he could have, and then it's, I'm 100% sure, that's exactly what he did. That is all I need. It sounds like you are totally lying, and you all are just doing your standard racist activity. When you go back, you work together, you get your story straight, this is how we're going to do it, and we're going to make sure that, you know, this little black child goes home for a day. We're going to go ahead and get this process started immediately. They already have the data, the research, those suspensions, how they lead to black children dropping out of school and prison, the whole nine. They already know this stuff. So to me, I'm in total agreement. It sounds like it was exactly white supremacy racism being practiced. They went, they got their story together, and we've already decided this is what we're going to do, and we're just going to get our words correct so that we can then do that. Importance of black independent institutions for black people to get education, homeschool, or if folks can kind of join resources together and do something, very, very important to keep that in mind, because it is, man, this is what you have to look 18 years of this, having to do battle with the racists that are taking care of our children, K through 12, anything extra. We basically did our three, unless somebody had something quick. I just wanted to make sure I read a segment from that Delaware report that I wasn't able to share. It's titled Racism Rampant in Delaware State Government. According to new report, It reads more than 100 state employees attended private hearings up and down the state over the summer to say they've been victims of racism. That's exactly what they say in the article, victims of racism. Some claim they were passed over for promotions despite having the necessary qualifications, while others said they were bullied or harassed. Those testimonies have now been compiled into a new report, a copy of which has reached the governor. One state worker who had an Aunt Jemima cookbook placed in her presence said Alicia Clark, an advisory consultant to IMAC, which is the Interdenominational Ministers Action Council. They were a part of the group that put this together. Those are some of the stories that we heard from state workers. Banana peels thrown in the walkway. Just overt work, racism in the workplace. Clark said that what's most troubling is that reported cases seem to have gone ignored. As far up the food chain as the complaint went, there was never really any accountability or a severe disciplinary action taken against those workers, which sends the message that it's okay to do this because there aren't any severe consequences that go along with it. The report found that 190 discrimination charges filed by state workers against various state agencies with the Delaware Department of Labor between 2012 and 2015, only one case was found to have cause. Reverend Dr. Sylvester S. Beanman, president of IMAC, called the DDOL the worst offender. I will end it there. You can feel free to go online and check out the report. It gives more information, and they have video from the press conference where some of the victims are speaking about their experience. But as I said, very important to talk about this, to document details so you have as much information as possible. Does anybody have a quick maybe sentence they want to get in before we wrap up, or is everybody satisfied? Right on. I will assume folks are satisfied. We will be here on Monday. We'll have a guest from Canada, black female, Ms. DeCoste. I hope I'm saying her last name correctly, but she'll be on the program. It's normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, talking about her views, experiences, racism, white supremacy in Canada. Hopefully our listeners that are in Canada can tune in, ask a question or three for the broadcast Monday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Dr. Welsing, the memorial again, it'll be January 23rd, January 23rd. I posted the details on my Facebook page. I tweeted them as well. You can get all of the details, date, time, other requests that the family has made for the event. That's 2 weeks from today, Saturday, January 23rd. With that, we will get ready to wrap things up. If you have any problems, questions, gripes, complaints, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. We are fundraising for 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Our blog address is racism-notes.blogspot.com. Address again is racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested and helped us keep rolling for nearly 7 years. I hope the program has been worthy of your time and energy and helped you get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what does it mean to be white. That said, as I always say, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Doesn't matter if you're going to be a driver, passenger, pedestrian, you do not want to be intoxicated should you bump into Brian Encinia, Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson. It is a horrible proposition under any circumstances, much less if you're not really thinking clearly because you've ingested whatever or drunk whatever. Just War is being waged against us 24/7 worldwide. Our behavior should reflect that, and making sure that we can make the best possible decisions at all time to keep ourselves as safe as possible and anybody else that we might be in charge of. Certainly, I would encourage you do not want to be around intoxicated whites. It is a dangerous environment. It can go from zero to lethal in a matter of seconds. I would even discourage being around intoxicated non-whites. It's just an environment that is rife with conflict and stupid problems most of the time. And we already got enough strife in our lives as victims of racism. We don't need anything added, and something particularly from something that can be easily avoided. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
no
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.